welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, going to be talking about the post office kind of caved and good. Going to talk about transportation funding on the state level. General Electric has announced that it's going to be moving good-paying union jobs from Pennsylvania to Texas. Gee, I wonder why. Also going to talk about the Screwquester. Where are the cuts? The right wing's telling me there are no cuts. Do you see anything? Is anything? Are the planes falling from the skies? Are they denying cancer drugs to cancer patients? Yeah. Oh, oops. So maybe the Screwquester is actually harming people. And trust me, we haven't seen the worst of it yet. It's coming. Also, schools for sale. Can't wait. Cannot wait for the land deal that is going to be our public education system. Oh, the privatization. Oh, the profit. Oh, I cannot wait to start my own charter school so I can, nice little land grab. Maybe some tax dollars go along with it. What do you think? Another ripoff. Anyway, we are back in the studio. I think all the bugs are worked out. I appreciate all the folks who sent well wishes, told us to hurry up and get back. Lots of things not happy. Anytime you move, trouble. Anytime you move, trouble. And we have had our share. Hopefully everything worked out from here on out. Now time to get back into the fight, move forward, stand up, and, well, be outraged. And there's a ton to be upset about. We're going to be talking today. You can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, comments, anything on your mind. The gun thing today, Joe Manchin and Pat Toomey had a little to do where they rolled out the idea that, well, we're going to have background checks. And, well, congratulations. You're with about 80% of the people who call themselves NRA members. The thing that gets me about this gun issue is nothing's going to get done. You need to understand that from the beginning. It's going to be a lot of posturing. It's going to be a lot of finger pointing, a lot of grandstanding, a lot of that. Nothing's going to get done. It's not. Because our system, until you and I fix it, right now is broken. Because we have too many people that we've put into these offices who don't believe in anything getting done, and they believe their job is to stop anything from getting done. So we've put people into positions of power who don't believe in what they're doing, don't believe in the institutions for which they're working in, thus they are destroying them. And it's going to take you and me, it's going to take us to get them out and to say this is the clear course we need to be going. There are so many things we need to be doing, folks. So much work that needs to be done. Our infrastructure needs tons of improvement. Bubblegum and barbed wire, not working anymore. Duct tape ain't helping. We need an actual infrastructural plan, not just in Pennsylvania, but nationally, across the country. So many things we need to do. We need a jobs bill. We need to put people back to work. And we need to finally, once and for all, solve the foreclosure problem. And I don't know if you've seen the news just within the last hour. A person with a gun was killed in Georgia holding firefighters hostage. And when I saw the original headlines, I'm going, well, another guy with a gun, wreaking havoc. But once you read into the story, it turns out here's a guy, who's leading the American dream. Had a house, lost his job. Here you go. Now you've got the foreclosure process, booted the curb, and they're auctioning off his house. And he evidently flips out, decides he's going to hold five firefighters hostage, and, nothing good can ever come of that. And now he's dead. And I look at, this whole foreclosure thing. Had we from the very beginning, and I've said this a number of times, had we from the very beginning taken the long view and done what they did after the Great Depression, because I believe we were in a depression thanks to George W. Bush and the pro-business policies that got us there, not just during the Bush years, but during the Clinton years and the previous Bush years and the Reagan years. All of this stuff compounded. All of this stuff built up to the point to where, thanks to bad economic ideas, this whole free market, let the invisible hand and let the robbers and the thieves run the barn, really destroyed our nation. And now you've got people who have busted their behinds, worked their entire lives for that dream. Because they were told, you know, if you work hard, you play by the rules. I love that friend. Play by the rules. Work hard. That you could have that little slice of the American dream. And it may not be much. Maybe your little corner of it. And then that collapse. Millions of people lost their jobs, lost their savings, lost everything. And then years. They're fighting with homelessness. They're fighting with unemployment. And they're fighting with a media structure that's pointing the finger at them. Because if you remember, after the Bush collapse, what we ended up with is a media culture, a right-wing, pro-business media culture that said, you know, it wasn't Wall Street that collapsed the economy. It wasn't those thieving marauders on Wall Street. No, it was your neighbor who was irresponsible. He thought he could own a house. Well, it turns out he couldn't. It was those poor people. And it was the Community Reinvestment Act. You remember this? It was those poor people who had the audacity to think that they could potentially own their own home. And, you know, I remember all during the Bush years, every year Bush would come out and say, well, you know, home ownership is at an all-time high. And every year it was an all-time high, and I'm proud of that. We've done this and we've done that. Never, he wasn't given any of the blame. It was Jimmy Carter, a guy who hasn't been in office 30 years. He was the blame. Wasn't the banking industry who no longer viewed your ability to repay the loan as a condition for you to get the loan, but them going, well, how much of the value is the property when I get to take it back from you? And now we see a story, and we've been seeing tons of these stories, where people who have been booted from their homes have had the ability to maybe gain a little bit back. And, you know, I saw a story right before we came on air that the average person who ended up settling got like $500. Just the average person. Because they didn't have the Justice Department behind them. And look, I'm glad to see this story that 316 service military people who had gotten kicked out of their homes had been improperly foreclosed upon between 2006 and 2010. These 316 people are going to get $36.8 million. About $117,000 a piece because they were improperly foreclosed upon. And I go, you know, what if we did that across the spectrum? What if we actually said, you know what, we're going to hold the banks accountable. We're going to actually make someone responsible for what it is they've done. I wonder how the banks would act if there were actual penalties. And I saw that Bernie Sanders is writing a bill to basically break up the 10 too-big-to-fail banks, which should have been done after the collapse. Instead of giving them more and making them larger and making them too big to be too big to fail, we should have broken them up and made them regional, smaller banks. You know, that competition thing, because honestly, I believe in that idea of competition. The sad reality is we don't have it. We've been sold this idea, you know, there's competition. There's not. There's not. And all of this stuff just, it sends me into a fit of rage when you see story after story. And I look at this guy in Georgia, and I know I'm sure 10 years ago, you know, he was a hard worker. 5 years ago, he was a hardworking guy just on the treadmill like the rest of us, trying to make ends meet. And because we've done really nothing to help these people who have been foreclosed upon, who have lost their jobs, who have been on the outside, there's part of me that goes, I'm surprised we don't see more of this. It's just one of those things. And I look at these budget proposals that are out now, the Obama plan, the Ryan plan. Foreclosures, that's a forgotten thing. It's a forgotten issue. We've basically forgotten these people. And there are millions more that are going on right now. And neither budget to me seems to be particularly something that I want to see passed. I mean, I got to be honest. The Obama budget, to me, the change CPI, I think, is a non-starter. Sorry, it's a non-starter. And I saw Paul Ryan was asked. He was asked if there was anything in his budget that he would put on the table. You know, they pointed out that D.D. Myers actually asked him. Obama's put this change CPI on the table, which has got the Democratic base, has got liberals and progressives and working class people like me kind of ticked off going, you know, this is the last thing you want to do. So D.D. Myers goes, hey, you know, Obama's done this. He's put this on the table saying, you know, he's willing to compromise. What have you done? And, you know, he falls back on, well, we put up balanced budgets. Well, where's the compromise? The Democrats want to have balanced budgets. They just want to raise taxes on the very wealthy to do that. Because, you know, in some households, when you have a budget deficit, you choose to bring in a little more income. Instead of saying to the children, sorry, you're not eating today, or sorry, you're going to go to school barefoot, you maybe work an extra hour, or maybe you take an extra job, or you don't cut food, you don't turn off the lights. What he said, what the Ryan budget is telling us they want to do is they slash the bones off. But he said, there's nothing more. He says that we've already done things to move to the middle to get common ground. And you go, really? What have you done? Because I've yet to see anything. I've seen vouchers for Medicare. Is that a compromise? No. I've seen more tax cuts for the very wealthy. Is that a compromise? No. I've seen more tax cuts for big corporations. Is that a compromise? No. I'm not seeing where the compromise is. I've seen the Republican Party take this and dig themselves in. But I've yet to see that compromise. And the messaging machine is saying, wow, it's all Obama. Have you seen the Republican budget? Have you seen the Ryan budget proposal? And did he run on that? Just a thought. Anyway, back in the studio tonight, every night. Hopefully the bugs are worked out. If you got any questions, any comments, we'd like to hear from you. As always, if you miss any portion of our program, therickssmithshow.com, where you can download the podcast. And if you want to contact me outside of giving us a call, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. We look forward to hearing your quick break. Right, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Sanitation workers at Republic Services Allied Waste in Youngstown, Ohio, have been on strike since March 27th. Picket lines have been temporarily extended to other Republic locations around the country in solidarity with the strike. The Teamsters say the workers are exercising their right to strike in protest of Republic's violations of federal laws protect worker rights, including the company unlawfully changing working conditions without bargaining. Teamsters spokesman Galen Monroe says Republic Services Allied Waste has a history of trying to squeeze workers, and that's triggering labor unrest.
This seems to be a corporate strategy to try and fatten their bottom line by squeezing the labor contracts and trying to get concessions on benefits and wages from these workers. We are trying to make sure that these workers' rights are protected. We are going to take this fight nationally. We want to make sure Republic and Allied Waste understand that this is not only Youngstown that they're attacking. They're attacking every single member in our union that works at Republic and Allied Waste. They are ready and prepared to stand strong with these workers to make sure that when their time comes to negotiate a contract, Republic Services Allied Waste does not try the same tactics with them.
The AFL-CIO says President Obama Tuesday took an important step toward restoring stability to the national system of labor management relations by nominating National Labor Relations Board members. Republicans in Congress are crippling the labor board by blocking all nominations to the board. Obama renominated Labor Board Chair Mark Pierce, a Democrat. Obama also nominated two Republicans, Terry Johnson III, a partner at Arendt Fox, and Philip Misamara, a partner at Morgan, Lewis & Bockius. Obama called on the Senate to quickly confirm his nominees. The AFL-CIO says workers need a functioning NLRB as it also urges quick Senate confirmation. German workers at a warehouse for online retailer Amazon could soon be on the strike lines. C. Russell reports.
The workers protested at a warehouse in Bad Hersfeld on Tuesday as a test run for the possible strike. Workers at a warehouse in Leipzig announced last week that they would likely be taking strike action soon, although an official date has not been set. The workers are demanding a minimum starting wage the equivalent of $14. 97% of members of the union Verdi vote in favor of strike action in the event contract negotiations break down. The pressure on Amazon in Germany comes only weeks after a German documentary alleged immigrant employees were being mistreated by security guards dressed in attire often associated with neo-Nazis. Country. Allegedly, the guards would frisk workers and search rooms to ensure no food was taken from the dining room. Amazon acted swiftly after the airing of the documentary and discontinued service with the security company.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Every now and then I visit an elementary school. Talking with children is a pretty good idea, I think. They ask questions we don't think about, and they ask them very directly. Recently, a little girl wanted to know, what's the hardest part of your job? That got me thinking. I looked down and I told her, the hardest part is telling people no.
Oh, yes, the hardest part is telling that little girl no. No, no education for you. No gym class, no art, no music. None of that. Nothing. Nothing for you. Factory work. That's a good thing. Put her back in the loom. She's got little hands, could do really nice little needlework, like in the old days. That seems to be what our governor is saying. You look at his budgets, you look at the priority that he's put on handouts to corporations, and not so much to public education. In fact, everything he's doing to education, in my view, is strictly in the vein of destroy it. And I look at Pittsburgh. Right now they've closed 19 schools and put them up for sale. And what I love is they've hired a consultant to sell them. Not a real estate agent who gets paid on commission, but an actual consultant who I think, the way it looks to me, gets paid no matter whether they sell or not. How do I get that gig? Oh, what we're doing to the commons of this country is just plain wrong. Which is why I've got our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, on the line. Irwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here, Rick, and boy, if I could explain what you just teed up, I wouldn't be on the radio tonight. I would be in the governor's mansion tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, Irwin, and I'm going, you know, it's not just Pittsburgh. It's Philadelphia. It's everywhere we look. I understand now as we speak, the York School District is thinking about handing the district over to these charter operators. And you go, where does it end? How do we stop it?
Well, where it ends, under this governor, unless we all step up to the plate and speak up loudly and clearly, draw a line in the sand, where it ends with this governor is that public education will be private education financed by taxpayer dollars and all that goes with that. You know, everything old is new again. And this old wine in a new bottle that they're selling us that they now call charter schools, this is nothing new. You know, in the 1800s, we had a two-tier education system. If you were rich, you had access to education. If you weren't, you didn't. And in the 100 years that followed, we made tremendous progress toward having a democracy in Pennsylvania because we made universally available high-quality public education for everybody. And now this governor is dismantling that piece by piece, and school districts are under enormous pressure. You know, these people, these right-wing conservatives who tell us how they want to get government off our backs and how they want smaller government and there's too much government. Well, these are the people that pass and impose and expand the law that requires our local taxpayer-funded school districts to shell out money to finance these corporate privateers of education in their so-called charter and cyber charter schools. And the school district and the people in those school districts have no choice. As a matter of fact, the law, as corporate and budget secretary, former education secretary Zogby, impose and enforce it, requires our taxpayer-funded local school districts to turn over money to the charter school privateer operators for profit before they invest the first thin dime on the school district-run schools. We have a situation, the school district in Delaware County, Chester Upland School District, 56% of that school district's annual budget goes to one charter operator corporateer who refuses to abide by, of all things, the open records law, the Pennsylvania open records law, you know, the law that gives us access to documents, the taxpayers funded documents. He refuses.
Well,
he's been ordered by a court and he refuses.
I see. I would say, well, then, you know, this is what happens when you have a private system. And then, and I've made the argument to people saying, look, you know, once we no longer control things ourselves through our government, we won't have to worry about the bickering. We won't have to worry about rallies on the steps. We won't have to worry about calling politicians or voting on any of this stuff. It'll just be imposed on us by people sitting in a boardroom. And we won't even know where the meeting is, let alone have a voice in it.
Well, we won't know where the meeting is, but where the money came from.
Absolutely.
Because the money's going to come from you and me and all of our listeners who are being taxed. And I don't know, maybe I'm just too much of a student of history, but I recall a Boston Tea Party where patriots, American patriots, heroes, tossed tea into Boston Harbor over a fight called Taxation Without Representation. Does any of this sound familiar?
Yep.
Any of it sound familiar? I mean, these charter privateers are the newest scourge. They're treasonous. I don't say that lightly. And it's taken me a long time to get to the point where I can utter that word. I had the thought and I couldn't bring myself to do it. But I'm telling you, it's treason. When you steal education from our children and make their parents pay for it, that's treason.
You know, we just came back from Washington, D.C., a group of educators and activists and parents and students from around the country came to D.C., the Department of Education building, for Occupy the DOE 2.0. And, you know, the message that I got out of this is that there is a movement. There are people who are waking up to this, fighting back against the Common Core curriculum, fighting back against this whole testing regime. And I want to talk a little bit about that here in the state of Pennsylvania. You know, you look at this all of this testing that's going on and all the data that's being collected and used against us. And I understand there's a movement of people saying, you know what, we're just not doing it anymore. And, you know, I understand right now the PSSAs are being given. I'm at the point now where I think we need to be saying we're not taking it. We're not doing it. Not
well,
letting
there's
our kids
a woman
do it.
In the Pittsburgh area.
Who we interviewed last week. We interviewed her here on the program.
I mean, she is my heroine of the week, maybe of the month, and maybe of the decade, where in conscience, as I'm sure she told you and the people who listen to the show, that in good conscience, she was taking her child out of that PSSA regimen. And we all need to know something. I mean, this is a legacy from former President Bush when they passed this so-called No Child Left Behind law. They created this requirement for standardized testing. And with that created an entirely new industry, these companies that develop tests. And it's a monopoly. I mean, every school has to administer them. And that means every taxpayer, once again, another unfunded mandate, every taxpayer to every school district is compelled to pay for something that is not education. Now, I remember a time in my life when people really, really complained about busing to achieve racial integration.
I was one of them. Because I was involved in it as a kid. They were shipping me from one side of the city of Cleveland, from one poor neighborhood, 2 hours away to another poor area in the city of Cleveland.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and people were up in arms that their taxpayer money, their good, hard-earned taxes, were being taken away from education and put into this busing. And we have school districts in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania has so many school districts. We have 500 school districts. We have some school districts that are organized in a very small, compact area solely and exclusively to avoid busing. And people complained about that. Now we are having taxpayer money confiscated to pay private operators to administer worthless, silly tests, and then we're going to evaluate the teachers in the classroom on the basis of how the students did on that test and take away tenure, take away promotions, take away salary, take away benefits, take away all the emoluments of employment from teachers because the kids don't do as a group as well as some privateer test administrator says they ought to.
And the thing that gets me with these tests is it's not even used for diagnostic. It's not even used to help figure out if a kid knows or doesn't know something. It's simply data for a corporation and for the district to say either you've made progress or you haven't as a school. It's not even individualized. That you would think with today's technology, it would be almost real time that you could make improvements. And look, I'm not against the idea of testing my daughter or my kids to know if they know something so you can help them learn that stuff. But this is not what these tests are doing.
Look, a school system is at its core a place where children get a respect for and a thirst for knowledge, information, learning, not test taking. And oh, by the way, just so that we understand where the Corbett people are, there are 12 so-called cyber charter schools in Pennsylvania, you know, those online virtual schools. Out of the 12, exactly zero, none, have made average yearly progress as measured by these standardized tests. And so the Corbett administration's response to that was first to manipulate how those cyber charter and charter schools reported their results so they could make it look better. And then when the government of the United States said, oh, no, you can't do that, then they did another little thing. They passed a teacher evaluation law, but it doesn't apply to the taxpayer-funded charter and cyber charter schools. It only applies to school district-run schools.
So let me ask you this, a straightforward question, because, you know, I know there are a lot of parents out there who go, you know, my kid's miserable coming home. I know my daughter is miserable coming home after these tests. You know, if you have a child, and I know you're a parent, I know if your kids were taking these tests right now, would you let them?
Absolutely not. No question in my mind, having spent the time that I spent with professional educators at the classroom level, at the department chair level, at the administration level, at the level of universities where we train teachers to teach, everybody for whom I have respect in the profession and all aspects of the profession unanimously tell me that they wouldn't have their own children take these tests.
So for people out there who would say, you know what, you know, tomorrow I'm not going to let my kid take the test, how do they do it?
Just tell the school that they're not going to, that they prohibit it, they permit it, they don't agree to it, and the school must acquiesce in that. There is a little known but very, very enforceable provision that says that no one has to compel their child to take those tests. They have a right to opt out. And this wonderful, advocate that you had on the show last week, who's a university professor. This is no street urchin. This is a very, very intellectually superior individual with a quality education and a very plain set of ideas about what education should be, is one of the people that has opted her child out. And you can just opt out and you tell the principal of the school, you tell the administrator, we're not doing it. And I encourage people not to have their children participate in this silliness. The kids are traumatized. The kids are overwhelmed. And by the way, the teachers are compelled to teach not reading and writing and not science and mathematics and not intellectual curiosity for the world around us. They're taught to teach the children how to take the test.
That's not education, Irwin.
That's anything but. Okay. This is the advocates of this are a group of people who think ultimately that we don't need classroom teachers, that they're just an evil that's expensive. We could stick kids in front of a computer screen, and the computer screen could do everything that a teacher does for our children. And I tell you, I've said it to you privately, I know, and I've said it, I believe, on this show. I am where I am today because I am the product of an extraordinary public education in the Pittsburgh public schools, and extraordinary dedicated public school teachers who, at the time I was their student, were getting next to nothing every year. $3,000 and $4,000 a year was their salary in the 1960s. And they were dedicated people, as the school teachers in our schools are today, and they taught me not merely how to read, not how to write, not how to do some basic mathematics. They taught me how to get out of poverty. And they taught me how to have a thirst for knowledge and an intellectual curiosity that is as burning as brightly today as it was when I was 5 or 6 years old.
So when you see what's happening to the Pittsburgh Public School District, and look, I mean, they're doing what big cities across the country, Chicago, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, you name the city, they're following the Broad Foundation's policies on going after the Broad Foundation on how to close schools and how to destroy public education. They're following the same path of closing schools and selling them off.
Well, it's a horror. And part of the reason it's so hard, look at Philadelphia as just one example. You mentioned Philadelphia and that litany of cities that are all facing this same insanity. Philadelphia is proposing to close 29 school buildings next year. Do you know how many of those taxpayer-funded schools that are closing are charter schools?
None.
None. The right answer. You win. Okay. Even though scarcely 28% of the charter schools in this state are making average yearly progress on these same tests that are the measure, not one charter is recommended for closure. Not one charter that's in financial trouble, not one charter that is failing educationally by their measures, not ours, not one charter that has operated without financial oversight, without accountability, without transparency, without even one parent on the charter school board. Not one charter that is erected on a building that's within 100 feet of a bar where alcohol is being served.
But, Irwin, I hear all the time how wonderful the charter schools are. In fact, I was coming to work today, and I heard on the radio, I think it was Connections Academy is running the latest bit of ads, a woman saying, you know, my daughter loves to dance, and school just gets in the way. So we're going to go to Connections Academy, and she can dance all she wants. And in the background, you hear her doing the tap dancing thing, and the woman says, so-and-so, you know, whatever. She goes, not now, I'm studying, Mom. No, you're not studying, you're dancing. There's a difference.
Well, you know, it's a bit of intrigue. There are not too many steps away from, oh, we need the kids to work on the farm or in the factory or in the mines. Don't make them go to school. They'll get that at night in front of the computer. Put them in the mine for 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
We're getting close. We're getting close. We're almost there. Put them on the farm. And oh, by the way, do you know who paid for that ad that you heard today on the radio?
You and
Connections
me?
Academy?
You and me and all the people listening and funding public education?
That's right. They're taking money that was supposed to be used to educate that tap dancing child, and they're using it instead to pilfer people away from the school district run schools and to do it with a promise. Look, I have four children who are now adults, a couple of grandchildren. Okay. I know something about parenting. There wasn't one of my kids during their preteen and teen years that wouldn't have done almost anything if they could have gotten away with it other than go to school.
Yeah.
Okay? That's the nature of the order of the world. And my kids are bright kids. My kids have all had the benefit of a wonderful education and have all gone on to college. And a few of them have advanced degrees beyond a bachelor's degree. And I'm very grateful for that. And they've turned many, many corners, and I'm proud of each of them. But I can recall when they were 10, 11, 12, 13, 15 years of age. And, you know, if I wouldn't have been there to kick them in the pants and get them out of bed in the morning, they wouldn't have leapt off to school. And I shudder to think what things would be like if they were in school today and heard on the radio that Connections Academy or the Agora Cyber Charter School or the you name it, I don't have to show up and I can get my diploma school was on their stations, their radio stations, their TV stations, advertising, was on the billboards that they see on the way back and forth to school on the school bus saying, you don't have to show up and we'll give you a degree.
By the way,
we don't even have to tell your parents how much we actually spend on the education we're not giving you. We just get to put it in our pockets.
And that's the bottom line. Last line of questioning I've got for you. I want to go back to the opt out. I want to go back to this testing stuff because I know a lot of people are I just don't want to put my kid in the front line. And my thought is the same thing. I want to opt my kid out. I just don't want them to be on the front line of this. But I just don't see that this is the right thing for them. And I know my daughter who came home today was just absolutely miserable. And I'm going to march my way down to school tomorrow and say enough already.
Good for you.
I can't have her go through another day like she did today.
Good for you. I couldn't be more pleased and I couldn't be more proud of saying that I know you. It's a courageous step. And I recognize that it puts the kids who are in that position in a little bit of a funny spot in relation to the other students and in relation to the teachers. But the teachers will protect your daughter, I'm sure, because the teachers are every bit as offended as I am and as you are by these tests and about what it's doing to the kids. And so there's nothing wrong and a whole lot right with that. And I'm sure you won't be alone because I know how much attention the opt-out movement has gotten in this state over the last 2 weeks alone as I've been watching it develop from the grassroots. It's not organized. There ain't any nutcase like me behind it saying go for it, although I support it intellectually. These are just parents, good, decent people who are concerned for their children and for their children's well-being in an immediate sense and for their kids' futures who are saying enough, enough with this insanity,
yep.
Enough with this garbage, enough with this anti-education. We send our kids to school for a reason, and the reason isn't to take tests that enrich some test-taking, test-administering, test-developing organization. And, oh, by the way, we have no reason whatsoever to believe that these tests have any dimension of integrity or honesty. We don't know if they're skewed toward whites or blacks or rich or poor or girls or boys or Native Americans or foreign-speaking or who knows what because, as you know, in another context, I litigate those kinds of cases that deal with how people get selected for jobs, university educations, all manner of things in which we as a society make choices about who's in and who's out, okay? And we don't know these testing facilities, these testing agencies, these testing modalities have not been tested. They haven't been reviewed. They haven't been determined to do anything. Except we do know that the schools in Pennsylvania that the taxpayers fund but that don't have accountability and transparency for those very taxpayers, the charter schools and the cyber charter schools, don't make the grade even on these tests.
And we know we're paying for them. And, as I've said about what they call No Child Left Behind, I've always called it No Child's Dime Left Behind because that's basically what it is, that education dollar that we thought we were putting into the future, we're just putting into these testing companies' pockets.
Yeah, to the degree one has the benefit of hindsight in looking at this, this was the corporatization of public education. And with all due respect to my many friends and colleagues who talk about the free enterprise system, I will confess to you that this is neither free nor enterprising. This is confiscation of tax dollars for purely private purposes and for the exploitation of our children who deserve so much better.
I'm right there with you. Irwin, I always appreciate the time and the input. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you. I hope to talk to you next week.
All righty. Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. I'm interested in your thoughts, questions, comments. Right back.
We can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13, voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
It was a gala evening of celebration, libations, commendations, and insidious corporate cynicism. Hosted in March by a financial trade publication, this annual Black Tie Awards dinner on Wall Street made news when the award for Best Crisis Management was handed out. Yes, an award actually exists for what amounts to PR deception, deflection, and dissembling by a corporation that has been caught making the year's biggest honking boo-boo. For example, the 2012 prize was taken by GE for its razzle-dazzle ducking and dodging over the fact that its reactors were at the core, literally, of the Fukushima nuclear nightmare in Japan. Equally stunning was this year's awardee, J.P. Morgan Chase. America's biggest bank was feted for its handling of last year's embarrassing discovery that, whoops, investors lost $6.2 billion in bad trades made by one of the bank's chief investment arms. Accepting the award for its media hocus-pocus, a Morgan executive quipped, "Crisis? What crisis?" Such gaiety, such absurdity, especially since a U.S. Senate subcommittee had just issued a devastating 300-page report showing that Morgan's destructive corporate culture, greed, and deception caused the loss, and that the bank's top executives repeatedly misled investors, regulators, and the public at large about what really happened. Not only did they mislead, but they did so illegally, for it's against the law for investment banks to make untrue statements about the risk of the securities they sell. This is Jim Hightower saying, but Wall Street narcissism appears to be an antidote to personal embarrassment, for Morgan's jolly bankers showed up to collect their crisis management award, even though everyone knew by then that they had grossly mismanaged their crisis. Wall Street is not merely absurd, it wallows in its absurdity.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So good news, the George W. Bush Presidential Library about to be dedicated. April 25th, I guess the Bush Library will be dedicated, open to the public on May 1st. Going to cost about $250 million to build. George W. has raised in excess of $500 million for a library that'll have basically no books. Maybe some pop-ups. Maybe The Very Hungry Killer, which he said was one of his all-time favorite books. My Pet Goat, maybe. Maybe this one will be right side up, maybe not upside down. I doubt Curious George will be there, because as a president, George was not curious. I doubt there'll be any looking finds, since he didn't bother really to look for Bin Laden, didn't find him either. So I don't think look and find was his strong suit. None of that. I think pop-ups, coloring books, you know, maybe stuff like that. My Pet Goat. Personally, I think April Fool's Day would have been a better day to dedicate the Shrub Library, but the good folks at the, and I got to think that, you know, Southern Methodist University, I got to think that this is a step down. Because I just don't think he was somebody, I don't think Bush was somebody who I would have thought intellectually curious enough to have a library. And you know what's interesting to me is that we're talking about, as a nation, closing down libraries. And school districts here in this state don't have librarians. Schools aren't going to have libraries. We're basically doing away with that stuff, but we got $500 million. $500 million was raised to build a George W. Bush Library. That seems really backwards, really bizarre, and really stupid to me. But I guess it is what we do. The other part of this is we don't get to know who the donors are going to be, who've footed the bill, because under law, presidential libraries don't have to give the names of people who have supported the presidential library. Other presidents in the past have. I don't know that the Shrub will. Now, you look at $500 million, pretty prolific. A very good fundraiser, George W. Bush was, because he was really very good to the very, very well-to-do. Made that class bigger. Made the working class poorer, but hey, you know, those aren't the people who are going to give you money to build a presidential library and remake your legacy over. Now, you understand, his legacy is one of failure and destruction and, you know, basically the nation going down the tubes. But, you know, he'll have a nice, spiffy presidential library, even if no child's dime left behind, is the rule of the land and is destroying our system around our feet. And to be honest, I don't think Obama's all that much better. I truly, Duncan's no better. The regime that's in power now that's pushing the same kind of things through, and it doesn't matter. Party doesn't seem to be all that big of a divider. The moneyed interests want public education to be in the hands of the privateers. And that's where we're heading. For different reasons, because I think Democrats have gone, well, you know, maybe there's a different way of, we want to have reinventing the wheel, and You know how you have a good education system? Maybe take some of that $500 million that you built a bad library, one that's going to have basically no books in it. Maybe you put that in investing into the future of education for kids. Just a thought. And if you remember Obama's State of the Union address, he said that he wanted to expand education funding so that we could have preschool for everybody. All kids could have preschool, could have pre-K, could make sure that they, first, I would have said all kids should have kindergarten, and we should, full day kindergarten should have been part of it as well. But they want to have a universal preschool program, which is part of the Obama budget, something I think is a good idea. Because, you know, I've read the studies that have said, look, you know, every dollar that you spend on these programs will benefit these kids over their lifetime of about $11 in economic benefit, because they're going to have lower teen pregnancy rates, lower dropout rates, higher attendance in college. So many of the positive things come out of this. And you mitigate some of the really negative stuff. You know, maybe if you invested in these kids early, maybe our prison costs wouldn't be through the roof. And look, there are a lot of ways of saying, okay, we believe education's a good thing. We believe that kids should go to school and good grades and work hard. There's a lot of ways of doing it. There's the way that I would would say, you know, incentivize it, have more opportunities for kids to be involved in the school, longer school days, weekends being open, you know, summer school, tutoring, all kinds of lots of after school programs, a lot of investment and more opportunities to be part of it. That would be my view. And there are some Democrats view that as well. Not all, but some. I don't know many Republicans who would take that line. In fact, the Republicans have kind of taken the other line, the punishment line. And I look at this guy from Tennessee who has come forth with a great idea, evidently. He believes that what we should do, and they have proposed House Bill 261 and Senate Bill 132, that would make anyone getting SNAP benefits, you know, the Supplemental Nutrition Food Program, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, the TANF stuff, anything that the family gets would be conditional on if the kids passed, if they got good grades. So if you got all straight A's, you get your $190 a month. B's, maybe you get $160 a month. C's, maybe $110 a month. D's, maybe $50 a month, and if you fail, you get nothing. No food for you. And you look at this and you go, wow, we're going to have poor kids responsible for if the family eats. I mean, think about this for a second. Think about what the Republicans in Tennessee are telling us. They're saying that, you know, things aren't bad enough for you, little Jimmy. You know, maybe you didn't have breakfast. Maybe you don't have shoes on your feet. Maybe the house is cold. Maybe you don't have a place to sleep. Maybe you're homeless. But in order for your family to get just $190 a month is nothing. But to get this little bit of assistance to help put food on the table so that maybe possibly you can maybe get through the day. If you don't do well, it's all on you. Think about the pressure that puts on a kid. I mean, we talk about this high stakes testing, and my daughter yesterday morning was an absolute pill. I mean, it was just, and I have no idea why, and I got to be honest, this is my fault for not knowing, but she was just, I can't say the word. you know, kind of with the B and N's and a Y, just real snippy and I didn't know why, and you know, the two of my wife and her are at each other all morning, and she comes home from school and is in a horrible mood, and then I find out it's because she spent the day taking these insane tests. And my daughter's a good student, been on the honor roll every opportunity. And I look at this and I go, is it worth it? Now think about if our survival, the fact of our ability to put food on the table was heaped on top of that pressure. Because look, my daughter understands. Her job is to get as good a grade as possible, to do everything that she can do, to be out, and it's expected that she's on the honor roll. It's expected that she gets good grades. It's expected that she works and she does everything that she's asked for. These tests, way too much pressure. And then you throw on top of that, you've got these people in Tennessee, these Republicans in Tennessee saying, well, now you got to do well on these tests or you don't eat. Are you kidding me? I mean, really, stop and think about this for a minute. And I think of the people who are struggling, the people who need this benefit right now. And you think of all of the things that we... I go back to my childhood, and I was one of the kids, and, you know, I'm not ashamed to say, you know, we were poor. I was one of the kids who, you know, you had to go in the special line to get the free lunch. You were always singled out. You were always, over off to the side, and everybody knew. I thought we were making progress towards saying, you know what? No kid should go hungry. No kid should bear that burden, that pressure of, you know, things aren't good at home. You know, I remember when my mother was out of work. It was a struggle. It was a constant struggle. And you heap on top of that all of the societal pressure on these kids to perform at such a high level because of these tests. And now you've thrown, not only have you thrown the teachers' well-being on it because these tests are tied to whether they have a job or not, but you're also throwing onto these kids that the school's future is based on whether they do well on this. And now they want to throw on top of that whether the family's going to eat or not. And look, this thing in Tennessee, trust me, it's not something this guy just thought of on his own, just didn't pull this out of his backside. This is something that's been prepared for him. It's something that you're going to see in other states. Because this is what we do to poor people. And what's interesting, since the Great Recession, there have been a lot more people who are in the poor category than there have been in many years. And I got to be honest with you, at some point, we've got to say enough already. Enough is enough. And I'm at that point. You know, having spent last week talking to educators across the country, talking to activists, and really digging into these, and I hope you listened to the programs we had last Thursday and Friday from our coverage of Occupy the DOE 2.0. If you didn't, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you can go get our podcast, or the Stitcher app on your smartphone, all right there for your enjoyment and your information. You know, those conversations I had with people both on air and off really opened my eyes to what's going on in this country with this whole testing regime. Because to me, it sounded okay. You know, hey, I want to know what my kid knows, what she doesn't, so that we can use these tests to say, okay, we're going to help make the things that she doesn't know more easily available so that she can learn them, and we can make sure she's where she... These tests don't do that. In fact, I guess we're not going to know the result for months. And you go, well, how is that helping them now? It's not. Which is why I think they're a bad idea. But we do have money for tests. Lots of money for tests. Not enough money for tutoring. Lots of money for tests. I just sit here shaking my head. And tomorrow is going to be a very interesting morning for the Smith household. Because, you know, yesterday, I can't let that happen again. It's just ridiculous and outrageous. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, going to talk about some funding issues for transportation. I'm going to talk with Mike Sterla, Pennsylvania State Representative, about his press conference and his ideas. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Sanitation workers at Republic Services Allied Waste in Youngstown, Ohio, have been on strike since March 27th. Picket lines have been temporarily extended to other Republic locations around the country in solidarity with the strike. The Teamsters say the workers are exercising their right to strike in protest of Republic's violations of federal laws that protect worker rights, including the company unlawfully changing working conditions without bargaining. Teamsters spokesman Galen Monroe says Republic Services Allied Waste has a history of trying to squeeze workers, and that's triggering labor unrest.
This seems to be a corporate strategy to try and fatten their bottom line by squeezing the labor contracts and trying to get concessions in benefits and wages from these workers. We are trying to make sure that these workers' rights are protected. We are going to take this fight nationally. We want to make sure Republic and Allied Waste understand that this is not only Youngstown that they're attacking. They're attacking every single member in our union that works at Republican Allied Waste. And they are ready and prepared to stand strong with these workers to make sure that when their time comes to negotiate a contract, Republic Services Allied Waste does not try the same tactics with them.
The AFL-CIO says President Obama Tuesday took an important step toward restoring stability to the national system of labor management relations by nominating National Labor Relations Board members. Republicans in Congress are crippling the Labor Board by blocking all nominations to the board. Obama renominated Labor Board Chair Mark Pierce, a Democrat. Obama also nominated two Republicans, Harry Johnson III, a partner at Arendt Fox, and Philip Misamara, a partner at Morgan, Lewis & Bockius. Obama called on the Senate to quickly confirm his nominees. The AFL-CIO says workers need a functioning NLRB, as it also urges quick Senate confirmation. German workers at a warehouse for online retailer Amazon could soon be on the strike lines. Jesse Russell reports.
The workers protested at a warehouse in Bad Hirschfeld on Tuesday as a test run for the possible strike. Workers at a warehouse in Leipzig announced last week that they would likely be taking strike action soon, although an official date has not been set. The workers are demanding a minimum starting wage the equivalent of $14. 97% of members of the union Verdi vote in favor of strike action in the event contract negotiations break down. The pressure on Amazon in Germany comes only weeks after a German documentary alleged immigrant employees were being mistreated by security guards dressed in attire often associated with neo-Nazis in the country. Allegedly, the guards would frisk workers and search rooms to ensure no food was taken from the dining room. Amazon acted swiftly after the airing of the documentary and discontinued service with the security company.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I know many of you are going to be interested in this next subject. Pennsylvania sits within a day's drive of 60% of the nation's population. Every year, nearly $500 billion worth of goods and services move through our state transportation system. Transportation is the bloodstream of our economy. If it fails, our economy fails. However, as you know, the average bridge in our state is 51 years old.
I gotta say, I sure hope that's not the case. I hope things don't go tumbling down. I look here in Harrisburg where 41 sinkholes in the last year. And I'm often asked, you know, what's it gonna take? Is it gonna take the governor's motorcade to be swallowed up by a sinkhole before we get something passed, before we start investing in our infrastructure? And his state of the state address said what was it? $1.8 billion he was gonna invest over the next 5 years? $1.8 billion. Sounds like a lot of money. The problem is according to his own commission, we've got a $6.5 billion need. So is he really meeting that need? Because the reality is, folks, we can't continue to patch our infrastructure together, our bridges together with bubble gum and barbed wire. Can't do it. We can't duct tape our way out of this. We can't. We need a real vision. We need real leadership. We need to be investing in our communities, our states, and our nation. We need to be doing it now. And the sad reality is the grades are in, folks. Nothing to be proud about. No honor roll here, which is why I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla to come talk to us. He had a news conference today on how we move forward, what we should be doing. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
So I look at this, $1.8 billion he's proposed to invest over the next 5 years on a need that his own commission, a commission handpicked by this governor, said is about $6.5 billion. Am I missing something?
Well, the commission actually said that the need is about $3.5 billion every year. They said they could probably get away with about $2.5 billion, and at least that way we would not be losing ground. We would be able to gain ground, but we wouldn't lose ground. Unfortunately, his proposal was $1.8 billion, that he gets to by year five. The commission also said that the problem is increasing at about $1 million a day. If you take 5 years times 365 days, you get times $1 million a day, you get to about $1.8 billion. So it was pretty much a status quo proposal, although there's some benefits to it. But I think all four transportation chairs in all the four caucuses have said they're interested in something closer to the $2.5 to $2.7 billion that the commission suggested.
So looking at what the governor said, 60% of the population a day's transfer, day's drive away, $500 billion a year comes through our borders, bloodstream of the state, our infrastructure, 51-year-old bridges. Again, I go back to leadership vision, not here.
Yeah, the sad part about this is that this commission report was done more than 18 months ago. The governor, when he got it, said he would look at it for a while and said that, certainly he would get it going on it shortly thereafter. We had a, proposal put before us by the governor back in February, but it was so inadequate that everybody said, well, we're going to have to sit down and figure out, where to get the rest of the money. So we're going to lose another construction season here. Instead of the governor leading the charge, he's basically leading from behind, and everybody's trying to push him to do what's necessary. There are several options out there as to where we can generate the dollars necessary. And when you talk to the driving public, look, nobody likes the idea of having taxes increased or fees increased or any of those kind of things. But what they hate even more is sitting in traffic for an hour trying to get to work in the morning, or hitting potholes and having their wheels need to be realigned, or skidding off the road and doing damage to their car. And it's actually costing them more to have bad infrastructure than it would to pay a little bit to make sure that the infrastructure is decent.
And here's the thing, for a governor who said he was going to look into creating jobs, again, he's been governor for over 2 years now. I've seen nothing on the jobs front. But I look at this, this is a great opportunity to put people back to work. And you said something there a minute ago that we're on the verge of losing another construction season. I would argue we've probably already lost it, because I don't think you guys can get anything passed quick enough to get things into the pipeline to get people moving right now.
Yeah, the sentiment now is that if we get a transportation deal done, it will probably be in conjunction with the budget. Which means that we're looking at the end of June, and till you put things out to bid and you can actually get construction contracts or together to put things out to bid, and then get the bids back and do anything, at best you're going to have a couple ribbon cuttings before the snow flies.
Here's the thing that gets me, Mike, and you guys are about getting reelected. To me, the idea of being reelected is getting people back to work and being able to say, we've created jobs, and having those ribbon cuttings and saying, look at the infrastructure we've brought you. There seems to be no downside to investing in our infrastructure, especially when you look at the fact that you talk to anybody who looks for locations to bring businesses. They say, location, 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 then infrastructure and education are the five things that they look for. 60% of the population within a day's drive. We've got location, location, location. Our infrastructure, one of the worst in the country, and this guy's turning education into one of the worst in the country.
Yeah, and it's really sad in the sense that right now is the time to invest in infrastructure from a state's perspective. Look, we know that there's a lot of people out there that are looking for work, and a lot of companies that do this kind of work are basically bidding it at cost just to keep their workers working. So your labor costs are about as low as they're ever going to be. The materials costs are as low as they're going to be, because you're not out there competing with the private sector right now. The private sector is in a slowdown. We know that. So there's an abundance of materials that you can get. If we wait until the economy turns around to do this, we're going to be out there competing with the private sector for employees and materials. The other thing is, by then the bond rates will go up also. Yep. And right now they're at an all-time low. So we could get labor for less than we could. We can get materials for less than we could prior to this. And we can get bond issue money for cheaper than we could in a long, long time. And now's the time to be doing this.
And you have the added benefit of a stimulus to get people back to work, and maybe those people would have money in their pocket to help the local communities start hiring people in local shops and help local entrepreneurs start businesses as well.
Yeah. And this is not like you're buying something that's going to last for a year. This is investing in infrastructure that, you know, as the governor points out, the average bridge in the state of Pennsylvania is over 50 years old. Some of them are 75, 80 years old. If we're going to build a new bridge, it's going to last us for another 50 or 60 or 70 years. So those are the kinds of things that you do a bond issue for, that you extend out over the life of the bridge, because that's the kind of thing that the next generation gets to use also.
Yeah.
So, you know, these kinds of investments are the kinds of things that you should be making, particularly in a down economy, to help with jobs and stimulating the economy.
Because, you know, I talk to people all the time and they say, you know, why aren't we doing these things? Why are we focused on dumb things like, oh, we need to privatize the liquor stores, and we need to sell off the lottery, and we need to do all of this nonsensical stuff that, you know, most of the people I talk to don't care about one way or another what they want. See, like you said, they want to be able to drive on the road, get to work, and not have their front end off alignment. They want to be able to send their kids to a school and the teachers not being laid off and study hall being the most crowded class. They want to have an infrastructure in our state, both educationally and you know, transportation wise, that's at least up to par.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at the priorities of what the Republicans in the House have done in terms of, you know, not dealing with jobs, not dealing with transportation infrastructure, not dealing with, you know, funding education, and conversely have dealt with trying to, you know, privatize a system. Just, you know, this week the big topic was whether or not we were going to neuter wild boars in game preserves. You know, I mean, that's
a job creator.
That's what seems to be, you know, dominating their agenda, as opposed to the things that I think are important to the people of Pennsylvania that are, in particular, you know, either looking for a job or working hard to try and make sure that they can make ends meet.
But it's a good thing you're the one who's there and not me, because I'd be strangling people. I honestly don't know how you guys do it. I would be losing my mind.
Yeah. Well, there's days it gets frustrating, but you know, it's one of those you got to sort of keep your nose to the grindstone here, or else you know, there's a tendency to get distracted with some of those things that go on.
And there have been a lot of distractions lately. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla. Mike, you know, I understand you had a media conference today proposing House Bill 1143 to help do some of this funding. Explain to me the idea.
Well, right now with the Motor License Fund, which is where all your gas taxes and registration and license fees and things like that deal with cars and trucks, all goes into a motor license fund. Unfortunately, we take, or I should say some people take, over $600 million right off the top and use it to fund the state police that patrol municipalities that don't have local police departments. Now, you know, if you live in one of those municipalities that doesn't have a local police department, that's great, because somebody's paying for your police protection. And it's basically the rest of the taxpayers in the state, because only 21% of the people that live in the state of Pennsylvania live in one of those municipalities that doesn't have a local police department.
So we've got some free riders that we want to pull along and bring them on the ship with us.
Right. And so what ends up happening is, you know, those people that live in municipalities that have a local police department, they pay local taxes for their local police department. The state police don't do routine patrols through those municipalities. And then they also send their state tax dollars to the state to make sure that somebody else gets the free state police protection. So what my proposal does is says, look, you know, if you're going to take that money out of the motor license fund for police protection, then take it out of the motor license fund instead of the money that you get for roads that we send back to local municipalities. But don't take that money off the top and then say, now let's sit down and talk about who gets road money. Because it's just not fair to the municipalities that are paying for their own police protection through local taxes.
Well, I mean, those municipalities should be sent a bill. Here's what it costs you for police protection. I know down, I think it was West York, who was, you know, taking bids on who was going to provide them with police protection. I don't understand how in this state we can have a municipality say, we're not going to do it, and we'll just let the state police do it for free. I don't understand how they can get away with that.
Yeah, well, there's actually what we've seen is a trend recently in the last several years with the downturn in the economy where municipalities have actually shut down their police departments because then they say to call up the state and say, okay, come patrol us. So that part of it, when you break it down, and I always break it down by legislative district. If somebody has a legislative district where 100% of their municipalities are patrolled by the state police, the state taxpayers are paying between $10 and $13 million a year to give that legislative district free police protection. Meanwhile, you take a legislative district like I represent, the city of Lancaster, which is about the size of a legislative district in the state of Pennsylvania. We spend in the city a little over $19 million a year on local police protection and don't get the $10 or $12 million coming from the state to help pay for that.
That's just
unfair to the taxpayers.
I agree. Sounds like a good idea to me. What are the chances of it passing?
Well, I think one of the reasons I've been pushing this legislation for several years or variations of it. When you think about the fact that we could actually be getting the $563 million back into the motor license fund if those they would actually go to the rest of the state for roads and bridges, that goes a long way to start getting to where we need to be on the transportation funding bill. If you take the governor's proposal of $1.8 billion or what the various transportation committees have said they want to do about $2.5 to $2.7 billion, and now you add another $500 million to it, now you're starting to talk the kind of money that's necessary to actually do the infrastructure development that we need in the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and this, it sounds to me like something that Republicans that I know would be in favor of, the people who believe in personal responsibility, because this sounds like one of those personal responsibility things.
Yeah, well, I've had people that say to me, hey, I pay my taxes too, therefore I deserve that police protection. And I always say to them, that's fine, but I pay my taxes too. Are you going to give me the same kind of benefits? Because if you would, the 79% of the people in the state of Pennsylvania that pay for their local police departments would need about another $1.5 to $1.8 billion sent to them. So if somebody wants to pay another, $2 billion in taxes, $1.5 to $2 billion in taxes, so that I can get those same benefits or my constituents can get those same benefits, then we can talk, But otherwise, I certainly expect those people to do what's necessary and, maybe increase their local taxes from 1 mil to 2 mils, to make sure that, their constituents get the kind of protection that they need.
That sounds like a smart idea to me, and maybe a way to help us repair some of our roads and bridges so that maybe we can attract some business to the area. Just a thought.
Yeah.
Representative, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Thanks.
Thanks so much, Representative Mike Sterla. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
Hi, my name is Ethan. My dad is a sanitation worker at Republic Services. My dad spends a lot of time away from home doing the fourth most dangerous job in America, but he is invisible at work, and Republic Services does not treat him with the respect he deserves. Support us on Facebook at facebook.com/Republic Services Teamsters. Thank you.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com. Search for The Rick Smith Show or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
A survey of stars in the Milky Way has revealed something new about how our galaxy formed. It found evidence that the inner, thin disk of the Milky Way grew organically from the inside out, like the rings of a tree. The surrounding outer disk likely formed all at once. Astronomer Judy Cheng of UC Santa Cruz was part of a survey of stars called Segway that analyzed starlight of 118,000 stars in the disk of our Milky Way.
We looked at different parts of the disk, so the disk can be thought of as two components. There's a thin disk, which is what you see in the sky, and then a thick disk, which is not visible from the Earth, but is made up of old stars.
Stars create heavier elements as they age, and when stars die, the heavier elements become part of the next generation of stars. The Segway survey analyzed starlight to reveal the metals in stars. The metals showed which parts of our galaxy have seen several generations of stars come and go.
The idea behind Segway is to use the stars that we observe and study their chemical compositions, look at their motions and also their positions in the galaxy to understand how the stars got there, when they were born, and how they fit into our picture of the galaxy.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
In fact, I was in a meeting in Wall Street, Rick, and it was a pretty stunning meeting because we were talking with them about, you know, how can we get more private investment in infrastructure? And they said, pay us. And you have to pay us not just the cost of the capital, like, you know, $60 million to rebuild I-80. You got to pay us for the profit that we would lose by putting that money elsewhere.
Looking at the governor's proposal, at his commission, his hand-picked commission's proposal. And it's, you know, if you do nothing, according to the graph here, if you do nothing, you know, they said, you know, back in 2010, it was a $3.5 billion need. If you do nothing, it goes up to $7.2 billion at the end of the decade. And, you know, if you look at, if you do nothing, you continually do nothing, that need grows and grows and grows, which is where I came up with the $6.5 billion number. This idea that $3.5 billion is each and every year, that Mike talked about is something that, you know, I'm kind of stuck on. I'm, wow, that's an even bigger need than I thought. If what Mike is saying, what Mike Sterling is saying is we've got a need each and every year of $3.5 billion. And this guy's proposed $1.8 billion over the next 5 years. We're really falling behind. And the D-plus rating that the civil engineers have come up with for the nation, we're not going to have a D, forget D-plus, you know, or D-minus, or we're going to be failing. And the governor himself said, we can't have that. And I look at this, and to me, this is a perfect opportunity. A perfect opportunity to create jobs, a perfect opportunity to invest, to bring companies here. Because anybody who knows anything about location, who knows anything about locating companies around, it's location, location, location. One, two, and three. It's you got to be where the people are. And as the governor pointed out at the beginning of the last segment, man, you know, 60% within a day's drive. We're within 60% of the population within a day's drive. 60%. We got the location. We got the location, the location, location out the wazoo. Problem is the other two things, infrastructure and education. And far down the list, really far down the list, are then tax codes and regulations and all of those other things. Comes down to location, 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 infrastructure, education, your top five. And I'm telling you right now, the whole idea of having the worst infrastructure in the country and moving towards an education system on the same vein is extremely problematic for the future of our Commonwealth, for the future of my kids, and it scares the hell out of me. And what is our governor doing? Well, not pushing through a transportation bill, not trying to save public education. He's actually in Brazil on a job, according on some junket, you know, paid for by the good people at Team Pennsylvania. I love that. It's one of my favorite, Team Pennsylvania. Very wealthy business people who have curried favor with the governor, to take him and his wife on vacation. They're in Brazil, Rio de Janeiro, where today, they have signed a joint declaration, with Rio de Janeiro. We need to create some opportunities and haven't seen what they are. They just had their little signing. They say they're going to enhance cooperation, with energy in the energy sector and mining. So basically oil and natural gas. They're going to drill oil. We're going to probably give them a bunch of natural gas. It'll be a swap. They're encouraging some college swapping, some organizations, you know, going back and forth. One of the things that the article I was reading talked about is that they're going to, according to this, you know, this announcement, which is part of the governor's jobs first mission. He's also going to Chile, going to do the Brazil thing, then over to Chile. The mission is going to, as the article said, focus on growing Pennsylvania's economy, creating jobs, because we want to export stuff. We want to attract investment, and they want to build relationships so we can have increasing port traffic, so we can import more stuff. Yes, what we need. And my other two favorite things that they threw out there, and I love this, we want to attract international students. We want to have a better recruitment of international students. We need more J-1 visa workers for our McDonald's and our Hershey's. We need more exploitable labor. They said that they wanted to promote Pennsylvania as a world-class destination for tourism. That kind of made me chuckle. Because, you know, I got to be honest, Rio is one of those places where you go, yeah, I would like to go to the beaches. I'd like to go see all of the skimpily clad lasses walking around in their bikinis, all tanned. And you know, I can see myself if I was living in basically a tropical paradise going, boy, you know, I'd really love a crummy winter. Give me some snow. I want to go to Pennsylvania. I'm going to leave paradise and I'm going to go to Pennsylvania. Okay. Maybe it'll work. You know, maybe we're going to attract tourism. Who knows? Anyway, on Tuesday, yesterday, the governor announced that they're going to bring a hydraulic cylinder manufacturer, to Franklin County. They claim it's going to create 74 jobs. They're going to have a new, manufacturing plant. So, we'll see. Now, it's interesting to me that he's in Rio de Janeiro, in Brazil, talking about bringing a hydraulic cylinder manufacturer from Brazil to Pennsylvania, yet he's nowhere to be found on a number of others. And I look at this story we're going to talk about in the next segment about GE, who I guess is threatening to close down their Erie transportation works. So that they can move that to Texas. And it takes me back to the guy, you know, a guy we interviewed some time ago who is currently working at the place where they're going to put the cracker plant. And the factory that's there, they're going to close down that has 500 workers there so that they can put in a cracker plant and give $1.7 billion for one that's going to create 400 jobs. Seems like a brilliant idea to me. And the guy said, look, you know, the governor's not into promoting retention of jobs. He just wants to create them so he can have the press conference. So 950 jobs in Erie appear to be leaving the state, and we're going to talk about that in the next segment, and they're going to bring in 74. So hooray. In governor speak, net win, publicity, big giant cardboard ribbon cutting ceremony. the 950 jobs, well, you know, it happens, right? Business friendly. Mind blowing. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about this, this GE situation. Again, another one of these stories where, in my view, this is about union busting. This is about screwing the workers. We're going to find out when we come back. Quick break, right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Razor Tattoos presents Get On Board, an art show to benefit autism. Get On Board features custom, one-of-a-kind artwork on skateboard decks from nationally renowned tattoo artists and fine artists. All proceeds go directly to the Autism Society, Greater Harrisburg area. The initial public showing will be during the Derby, Inc. Invitational Tattoo Convention at the Farm Show Complex, April 19th through 21st. Visit facebook.com/getonboardforautism. That's facebook.com/getonboardforautism. Sponsored by Razor Tattoos.
Hi, my name is Ethan. My dad is a sanitation worker at Republic Services. My dad spends a lot of time away from home doing the fourth most dangerous job in America. But he is invisible at work, and Republic Services does not treat him with the respect he deserves. Support us on Facebook at facebook.com/Republic Services Teamsters. Thank you.
It was a gala evening of celebration, libations, commendations, and insidious corporate cynicism. Hosted in March by a financial trade publication, this annual Black Tie Awards dinner on Wall Street made news when the award for Best Crisis Management was handed out. Yes, an award actually exists for what amounts to PR deception, deflection, and dissembling by a corporation that has been caught making the year's biggest honking boo-boo. For example, the 2012 prize was taken by GE for its razzle-dazzle ducking and dodging over the fact that its reactors were at the core, literally, of the Fukushima nuclear nightmare in Japan. Equally stunning was this year's awardee, J.P. Morgan Chase. America's biggest bank was feted for its handling of last year's embarrassing discovery that, oops, investors lost $6.2 billion in bad trades made by one of the bank's chief investment arms. Accepting the award for its media hocus-pocus, a Morgan executive quipped, "Crisis? What crisis?" Such gaiety, such absurdity, especially since a U.S. Senate subcommittee had just issued a devastating 300-page report showing that Morgan's destructive corporate culture of greed and deception caused the loss, and that the bank's top executives repeatedly misled investors, regulators, and the public at large about what really happened. Not only did they mislead, but they did so illegally, for it's against the law for investment banks to make untrue statements about the risk of the securities they sell. This is Jim Hightower saying, but Wall Street narcissism appears to be an antidote to personal embarrassment, for Morgan's jolly bankers showed up to collect their crisis management award, even though everyone knew by then that they had grossly mismanaged their crisis. Wall Street is not merely absurd, it wallows in its absurdity.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? Time to let these people learn the lesson.
You know, I want to
Oh, yes, the Republican dream. Lower wages, no health care, no pension, no benefits, no say, no voice, nothing. You are, well, you're a tool. You're just a piece of machinery to be used and discarded at will. I mean, that's the direction we're going, isn't it? And if you remember, I guess it was about a year ago when we talked about the Caterpillar division in Canada that told its workers, you're going to take a 50% pay cut or we're moving to the U.S. Remember that? And I said, you know, when they come to the U.S., and they did with a 50% pay cut, I said, there's going to be fallout from this. You're going to see falling wages across the industry. And now I see this story in Erie, Pennsylvania, where for the longest time I've been saying, you know how we get people back to work? Public transportation. Get that plant in Erie that makes locomotives. Get them back to work by producing high-speed rail. Get them back to work by producing public transportation. Good idea. Problem is today I see a story that the company is planning on eliminating 950 union jobs and 100 management jobs because, well, they want lower wages in Texas. And they've announced that they're going. But maybe the union can give some concessions. So here to help me work through this, I've got Chris Townsend. He's the political action director with the union that represents those 950 workers with the United Electrical Workers Union, UE. Chris, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So I look at this, and am I getting this right? They've announced that 950 jobs are going to be cut. They're moving. They're going to run off to Texas, but maybe they won't. If maybe you give concessions, or if you, well, give in.
Well, it's all of that, but back up a little bit and just a little detail to fill in. And this is a story that really needs to be told because it's a cautionary tale for all of manufacturing. You're right about the Caterpillar experience, the sending of the jobs from the well-paid unionized plant in Ontario down to Muncie, Indiana. The GE scheme to move the jobs from Erie to Fort Worth is unusually similar. Almost identical, and that's a whole aspect to this which I think folks should stay tuned. We may yet see this curious form of competition turn out to be something else. But in the interim, it is exactly as you lay it out. The company has given us the notice that over a period of months, they intend to move several of the key product lines to the Texas facility, which was set up about a year ago and announced about a year and a half ago. And, of course, that plant is what GE refers to as a competitive wage plant, which means that the workers earn, and in the case down there, all new hires for the most part, very low wages, in many cases half of what the wages are in Erie. They have no pension, and the health care that they have is very costly. Of course, there's no union premiums such as overtime after 8 or Saturday overtime. We have no idea of what holidays and that sort of thing will be. Suffice it to say, it will be much less compensation for the workers down there. And when you mention the positive aspects of public transit and rail, one of the things I should mention here is it appears to us, and we've been on this, ringing this alarm bell for several years, is that it looks like General Electric has chosen this particular moment to do this because it has exploited the ignorance and inaction of the political leadership, the complicity, it looks like, of the Obama administration in the last few years on this question to sort of shoot the works here at this point and make this transfer. So our local has announced its fullest intention at all levels of the union to resist this with every tool at our disposal. And if it ends up that the work goes, it won't be because we cooperated with it or conceded down to poverty wages.
Because, you know, that's the point in this. You know, I look and I brought up the Caterpillar thing, and I remember at the time saying very specifically, watch, this is going to be what happens across the industry, because this race to the bottom, this competition to the bottom is a model that corporations are going to use to pit us against each other. And they've done it masterfully. As I understand, this plant in Texas that they built, I guess, about a year and a half or 2 years ago, was set up specifically as an overflow facility to take on the work that maybe you guys couldn't do at the time. You know, as an overflow facility, now it seems that really probably wasn't the main idea to begin with.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, this was the explanation handed out for those who either don't care to question General Electric or might not know any difference. And that's probably a lot of folks out there. And when you trust GE, you trust them at your peril. And this, of course, was a situation that we knew would come when you build a lot of extra capacity in your manufacturing, and then you have two primary businesses, off-highway vehicle, motorized wheel, it's referred to as, and rail locomotives. When you have long-cycle businesses that have ups and downs and always have had, you know, and you have a downturn in the cycles of these businesses combined with this all this added additional manufacturing capacity, of course you're going to have layoffs. Of course you're going to have a deeper recessionary type impact. And the thing that's distressing about this, though, is to see that this really is this competitive wage reduction. This is not wages, as you had mentioned in your introduction, as I even catch myself saying, we say that wages are falling. We ought to correct ourselves when we say that. They're not falling. They're being driven and pushed down by the corporate forces and increasingly government forces. And this is essentially the U.S. austerity, which we may not even recognize is happening. And that's what's happening. The General Electric Company, we have a, for those who want to go on our Facebook page, we have a Facebook page if folks can remember it if you search for this. It's called Stop GE Wage Cuts. It's a Facebook page, Stop GE Wage Cuts. If folks visit that page, they will see some of the most astonishing, maybe not. GE workers are working for $8 an hour in the United States, $13 an hour, $15 an hour, 45% wage cuts on long service workers, 25% wage cuts on long service workers. And I'll give my union credit. We have been ringing this alarm on General Electric for many decades, and we've been ringing it louder and faster in the last few years because, tragically, the love affair that the political world has had, including the Obama administration, with this corporation, going back to when GE CEO Immelt was appointed to be the job czar, the jobs council head. This is what their program is. This is what they mean by the Jobs and Competitiveness Council. Let's have workers working for what General Electric defines as competitive, which is $13 an hour if you're in manufacturing. Not so sure whether that's a starting wage or whether you aspire and move up to that wage, but $13 an hour, no pension, health insurance that you pay the vast bulk of the cost, and, of course, no union. They will invest millions in union avoidance to prevent any collective action on the part of the workers to try to improve that situation. Well, this is now, of course, shared by wide layers. Certainly it's shared by Caterpillar, and it's shared by other manufacturers, all who imitate GE, because the super profits are the result. And I should mention that the Erie plant where these jobs are being, or at least the company has announced that they're going to take them out, the GE Transportation Division in the last 5 years, and everyone think about the last 5 years and the difficult economic environment that we can't deny, this division, which is primarily based in Pennsylvania, Erie and Grove City, Pennsylvania, has earned more than $3.5 billion in profits. So there's absolutely no economic reason to move to Texas or to ask for concessions of any kind.
Well, but there is. They want more.
Well, exactly. That's right.
I mean, they want to take from you and give to the CEOs and the executives. And it's what's going on across the country. And the reason that I think it's important to highlight this is it's just not GE. It's all across manufacturing. And I keep hearing people saying we need to bring manufacturing back. And I say, yeah, I agree. But at what cost? If we bring manufacturing back and we bring back the Chinese labor environment, is that good for the country? Is it going to help our middle class? And I say no.
No, of course you get your calculator out. It's not really an argument. It's a matter of fact. When you have workers working for what they describe as a competitive wage, $13 an hour, you can't possibly be in any condition other than impoverished. And that's not a prescription for anything but wider and more widespread impoverishment. And one thing I should mention on General Electric, which is maybe somewhat different than other companies. You know, we refer, and it's a normal reaction for folks to think of General Electric as a manufacturing company, because that's the pieces of the company that most people are familiar with, light bulbs, washing machines, other appliances they may still have. But we ought to get something on the record. The General Electric Company is not a manufacturing company so much as it is a bank.
Yep.
It's the seventh or eighth largest commercial lender, and it actually is now chartered as a bank, and it's a very damaged bank.
Now, didn't we bail it out?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things we constantly point out to our members and the members of the other unions in General Electric is that this company wrung the profits out of the manufacturing subsidiaries in the Jack Welch era in order to get the company into all these various far-flung capital, GE capital and financial and insurance and real estate and banking businesses. And now that many of those businesses have gone sour, and gone sour to an extent that the company was severely damaged and impaired in 2007 and 2008. Now the businesses are being squeezed and wrung out again to prop up these losses, which are ghastly and which go on. And on top of all of that, they still return a humongous profit to their shareholders. So this really is a money machine in General Electric, but it just makes it all the more objectionable when they make these kind of moves like they've have thrown down the glove to the UE members in Erie, Pennsylvania, and we intend to take on the fight.
And good for you, which is why I say everyone should have a voice. Everyone should be a member of a union. Everyone should be a member of an association, a guild, whatever you want to call it, but an organization that's going to stand and fight for the workers so they don't get screwed and they're not standing there alone. And the thing that bothers me is they're taking away health care and they're taking away pensions and wages. And I think of Jack Welch, the retired CEO, who to this day still gets fresh cut flowers every day for free in all of the GE owned apartments and houses that he inhabits across the world. He gets all of these wonderful perks and use of the corporate jet and personal secretaries and his taxes paid and financial planning and all of these wonderful things at the expense of people like your members in Erie who are doing their, who are busting their butt to make those profits for him. And that's what's infuriating to me. And the other part of it is I think of all of the tax subsidies that we give them, all of the handouts, and the fact that they've walked away, for the most part, walked away from paying taxes in this country altogether.
Well, that's right. Get this one on the record. This one is another one of these problematic facts for people that want to defend this corporation. The General Electric Company, this year, I read their 10K, which is a 200-page mind-numbing project, too, but someone has to do it. And it looks like in 2012, the General Electric Company paid what amounts to an effective tax rate of about 2.8% on a profit of $8.4 billion.
Wow.
And if you go back the previous decade, that's just about what their profit rate has been. Bob McIntyre and the Citizens for Tax Justice Organization did a 10-year look back on GE a couple years ago when they had the phenomenally embarrassing tax return of 2010 where they actually got several billion dollars refunded to them by the taxpayers. So this really is a company that in so many different ways is challenged by the facts. It's a company that continues to avoid taxes at all levels in a magnificently appalling way. It continues to claim to add jobs in the United States while all indications are that it continues to exit these shores. It's a company that has shown every imaginable consideration by whatever regime is in power, Democrat or Republican, in terms of its exalted status in many different ways. And of course, probably most tragically and difficult at all is that it is worshipped and imitated by so many different companies because, of course, the profit results are there, if that's all that matters. So it's a very problematic thing when GE, companies such as General Electric, companies such as Walmart, these type companies become the exalted, worshipped, imitated corporations on our shores. And I just walk around our communities and we see what the result of that is.
Yeah, I go back to the 60s when they said, you know, as General Motors goes, GM goes, the nation goes, because they were raising wages and raising conditions because the unions were demanding it. Now we're seeing the Walmarts and the GEs, as they go, the nation goes down with them.
Yeah, absolutely. No, when we began to detect this, began to get vibrations, have people contact us when we began our perpetual outreach to non-union GE workers. Several years ago, when we began to detect this wage cutting, you know, think about what this means. We're not just talking about a company who retires or fires an older worker and hires a young worker. You know, the young generation has been screwed over with two-tier and reduced-tier wage systems for a number of years, decades perhaps. But we're talking about a company that we began to figure out was taking long service. I think of the example of Mebane, North Carolina. A group of manufacturing workers in General Electric 2.5 years ago, the company calls in a number of them, gives them letters on a Thursday or a Friday and tells them on Monday morning, you're going to be working for somewhere between 25 or 45% less wage than you were that day. And for a long service worker in GE, depending on where these communities are, what are you supposed to do? And there's other anecdotal examples like that on our Stop GE Wage Cuts Facebook page where we've put these things up because we don't have a magic wand and we do constantly undertake union organizing efforts in GE and of course they ferociously resist unionization, but I don't see any other possible way to confront this other than to expose it, shame this company if they can be, publicize it, and then ultimately hopefully recruit workers to to form their own organizations and fight back against this because we certainly don't see very much help coming on the political front. And, it's time to be self-reliant, I suppose. Nobody's going to look out for you in these situations if you don't look out for yourself. So, maybe that's a return to what our labor movement had to face 70 and 80 years ago. It's kind of a shame that it comes to that, but so be it.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is, as you pointed out, on a Friday they get a letter. Monday you're making 25 to 40% less, and they can do that without a contract, which is why, again, I say every working person should be a member of whatever you want to call it, a union, association, a guild, an org, whatever, and have a contract that says, you know what, you can't do that. Because I know every CEO in this country, they've got a contract.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, if folks do visit that page, they'll see these documents, where we've been able to get a hold of them. We've posted them pay charts with vast wage reductions from what they refer to as legacy employees, which is the current rate of pay, to competitive, always the competitive wage. And in our 2011 national union negotiations with GE, which I've been a part of for 25 years representing UE, I chased them around for the month we were in New York City battling and bargaining that contract. And we finally did get them in fragmentary ways to define what they list as or what they speculate as competitive, which is that $13 an hour level with no benefits. And, of course, when I questioned the company negotiators as to whether they thought that that would be a survivable, dignified wage for their family or their children, of course, you know, there was no desire to have that conversation.
They don't care. So, they don't care. I mean,
no.
If we can create desperation nation and they can pay desperation wages, so much better for them. Not so good for a nation, not so good for your communities, not so good for your future and your families, but good for them.
Right, right.
Let me ask you a last line of questioning, though, because
sure.
One of the canards that came out in this article that I saw from the Erie Times News that I've heard a lot of, and it came up during the 2012 presidential election, and it comes up all the time, you know, these onerous union rules. You hear this all the time, you know, there are these work rules that are really, they're just killing us. We can't compete with all these rules. First, anything that happens in the job site, anything that happens, that's something that was negotiated, right?
It is. It you're right. It's a, the company, other companies do it as well. It's an easy crutch. And the media repeats whatever they say, more or less. You know, we're not flexible enough. We're not competitive enough. This is nonsense. Our membership goes to work in Erie, and we work in a tremendous number of scenarios. Many of them are self-directed. They don't need to be managed. They know what to do. They know what work has to be done. We have phenomenal organizational problems in that plant. One might imagine that putting together locomotives and other complex pieces of machinery like that, there's a tremendous number of parts and sub-assemblies that have to come in. And we've had many complaints. Actually, one of the things that we will be doing in the next months is ramping up a standard committee that we have under our union contract that's called the Job Preservation and Growth Committee. This is a committee that the company agreed to, and we essentially help them manage. And we've saved and brought back hundreds of jobs and showed the company how to better manage its own facility. We probably shouldn't have to do that in a perfect world, but we will do that, and we do that.
Right.
But for the company to then come out and say, well, all these work rules impair us, it's nonsense. It is nonsense. But this is just another one of their explanations in order to somehow give themselves the legitimacy to do what it is they're doing.
So what can our listeners do? Is there a way to put pressure? What should I be doing?
Well, what we're going to do, keep in touch with us. Keep looking at our main webpage, which is ueunion.org, ueunion.org. We're going to have updates up there. We're going to be doing a number of public events, a number of things which we're sort of in the planning stages of. It will be in the news when we have news. And if folks want to contact their politicians, their elected officials, whatever state they're in, I mean, the question is, how much longer are the elected leaders at the national level especially, how much longer are they going to maintain General Electric in this exalted status, this tax-free status, this status where their imposition and their leading of the charge on this competitive wage reduction, how much longer is this going to be tolerated? Folks probably know that the Jobs and Competitiveness Council died on the vine last year, and thank goodness. Let's throw some more dirt on top of that and bury that for all time, because we don't need a wage cut committee. But anyway, folks need to start questioning this corporation, because it really is a sad example of how the political leadership in both parties, virtually all the Republican Party and large sections of the Democratic Party, they're catered to, they're exalted, they're uplifted, and it shouldn't be.
Yep.
We should be looking at improving the standard of living and uplifting wages and working people's condition. That's the secret to get out of this malaise that we're in. So.
The sad reality, though, Chris, is we're told that we need to be business friendly and we can't intervene in the free market, because that would be bad for business. Yet I go back to the good old days of the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower, when we had 35% unionization rates. Families were able to have one person working to support a family. Seemed like pretty decent times back then.
Well, it is. I mean, it's we live in a boom and bust economy. You know, the employers have gained the upper hand in many, many ways. The union slice of it has been, what are we reduced to, 10% of the economy, more or less, and it shows. And of course, what I say is, and I would say this to the listeners, the folks that are union conscious, the folks, we've got to do better. We've got to rebuild these unions. We've got to organize the unorganized. We've got to take the offensive. And that these perpetual defensive struggles and politicians who want to act like they're an umpire in some equal contest, they can all go you know where, as far as I'm concerned. We need to stand up for ourselves and push back, and that's the only place where progress has come from. Maybe it shouldn't have had to come to that, but it has.
Well, you got to get people activated, engaged, informed, and in the streets, agitated as well. Chris Townsend, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I look forward to having you back again. Chris Townsend, Political Action Director with the United Electrical Workers Union. We've got a link to the websites that he put forth at our website, thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Chris's name. It'll take you right there. You know, I look at this, and again, I go back to this. When we were talking about it, I go back to the retirement contract that Jack Welch, the former CEO, got for himself. And, you know, it just blows my mind. You know, fresh flowers every day and all of the residents that he has access to, use of the Boeing jet, you know, because the corporate jet's there for his disposal. You know, tax planning. They pay all his taxes. They give him all, because this all came out in the divorce settlement with his wife. He gets tickets to, you know, the World Series, all of the Olympics, the Red Sox, the Yankees. He gets all of this stuff heaped on him because, well, he's Jack Welch, you know, the guy who brought us China, China, China. And I've been saying for the longest time, we've given these companies like GE so much power over our national economy because they're leaving. And we give them huge tax subsidies. And the one thing I forgot, and next time we have him on, I'm going to ask him, you know, how much tax subsidies went into this plant in Erie? You know, how much money from the state, how much money from the local community went into the tax abatements and free whatever to create that environment? And then in Texas, how much went into that? What I love about these scenarios, and right now where I live in Carlisle, they're tearing down the Carlisle Tire and Wheel plant. Just ripping it to shreds because Tennessee gave him $34 million to move. What company wouldn't do that? We're killing ourselves, and we're using our government, our tax dollars to do it. We're the cause of this race to the bottom because we keep putting these people who promote this stuff into power. It's insanity to me. And then we complain, oh, the economy, Obama's not turning around the economy because we've got all these business-friendly idiots. And Obama's one of them. Look, I've never been happy that iMelt has been the jobs guy. I was never happy that Cody, the guy from Honeywell, was on that council while he's doing everything he can do to break the union at Honeywell in Metropolis, Illinois. You know, there's so much of this. We have got to put a stop to this. And it's about getting activated, engaged, informed, and in the streets. We got to do it. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you can get the podcast. I'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, comments. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, back with Hour 3. Stick around.
The con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Sanitation workers at Republic Services Allied Waste in Youngstown, Ohio, have been on strike since March 27th. Picket lines have been temporarily extended to other Republic locations around the country in solidarity with the strike. The Teamsters say the workers are exercising their right to strike in protest of Republic's violations of federal laws that protect worker rights, including the company unlawfully changing working conditions without bargaining. Teamsters spokesman Galen Monroe says Republic Services Allied Waste has a history of trying to squeeze workers, and that's triggering labor unrest.
This seems to be a corporate strategy to try and fatten their bottom line by squeezing the labor contracts and trying to get concessions in benefits and wages from these workers. We are trying to make sure that these workers' rights are protected. We are going to take this fight nationally. We want to make sure Republic and Allied Waste understand that this is not only Youngstown that they're attacking. They're attacking every single member in our union that works at Republic and Allied Waste, and they are ready and prepared to stand strong with these workers to make sure that when their time comes to negotiate a contract, Republic Services Allied Waste does not try the same tactics with them.
The AFL-CIO says President Obama Tuesday took an important step toward restoring stability to the national system of labor management relations by nominating National Labor Relations Board members. Republicans in Congress are crippling the labor board by blocking all nominations to the board. Obama renominated labor board chair Mark Pierce, a Democrat. Obama also nominated two Republicans, Harry Johnson III, a partner at Arendt Fox, and Philip Misamara, a partner at Morgan, Lewis & Bockius. Obama called on the Senate to quickly confirm his nominees. The AFL-CIO says workers need a functioning NLRB, as it also urges quick Senate confirmation. German workers at a warehouse for online retailer Amazon could soon be on the strike lines. Jesse Russell reports.
The workers protested at a warehouse in Bad Hersfeld on Tuesday as a test run for the possible strike. Workers at a warehouse in Leipzig announced last week that they would likely be taking strike action soon, although an official date has not been set. The workers are demanding a minimum starting wage the equivalent of $14. 97% of members of the union Verdi vote in favor of strike action in the event contract negotiations break down. The pressure on Amazon in Germany comes only weeks after a German documentary immigrant employees were being mistreated by security guards, dressed in attire often associated with neo-Nazis, confiscated rooms taken from the dining room. Amazon acted swiftly after the airing of the documentary and discontinued service with the security company.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So the right wing all a tizzy over this story that there are cancer patients, seniors who aren't getting chemotherapy because of the sequester cuts, because, oh, no, it's Obamacare. And then on the other side of this, I keep hearing people saying, well, you know what, the sequester happened, but did you notice it? Are there planes falling out of the sky? There's nothing bad happening. So which is it? Which side of this argument are you going to take? Because Republicans, you can't have it all. You can't make all arguments all the time and still say nothing's happening, nothing's bad, we did nothing wrong. Just can't have it. So here to talk about this story of these seniors who aren't getting cancer care because of these sequester cuts, I've got Sai Mukherjee. He is a health reporter and blogger over at thinkprogress.org. Sai, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
So tell me about this. There are senior citizens who are not getting chemotherapy in this country. Why?
Okay. So the chemotherapy that is being denied to Medicare beneficiaries is solely a consequence of the sequester cuts. It has absolutely nothing to do with Obamacare, and anyone who claims otherwise doesn't understand how Obamacare works, doesn't understand how the sequester works, and doesn't understand how federal budgeting works in general. First off, anyone who's claiming that this is a consequence of Obamacare doesn't get how Obamacare actually achieves its Medicare savings. What Obamacare does is it saves $716 billion over the course of a decade by reducing historically excessive payments to providers that service private Medicare Advantage plans. That is a cut to those providers, and it is a cut to payments that almost any, you know, any honest health policy analyst will tell you have historically been excessive. So that does not affect anyone's benefits. That's not going to prevent anyone from getting care.
Walk me back through this walk me through this Medicare Advantage, because I think it's important for people to understand that there's Medicare, like my grandmother gets, and then there's this,
right.
There's the Plan A, and then there's the Medicare Advantage, which was, as I remember it, and as you, maybe you're the expert here, was during the Bush years something that they created to help privatize Medicare.
Right. So, you know, Medicare, the program, you know, without getting into too many technical details, it's broken up into four main parts, parts A, B, C, and D, right? A and B are the ones that, you know, people know about the most. Those are the most common ones. Those are the ones that have to deal with inpatient and outpatient care. That's A and B. And Part D is the prescription drug benefit. Medicare Part C is what is Medicare Advantage. And what this is basically is it allows Medicare beneficiaries to enroll in a private plan and receive their benefits through that private plan instead of traditional fee-for-service Medicare. Historically, what's happened is that those plans come in over budget, whereas fee-for-service Medicare comes in under budget.
Right. And so, the part of this, and this is where, when it was passing, what I was saying, this is the poison pill that's going to destroy Medicare. It's, in my view, and this isn't something that you have to agree with, but Part C and Part D, in my view, were the things that were going to destroy Medicare faster. We're going to put huge mandates on them, like not negotiating for prescription drugs, and, oh,
right.
By the way, putting a profit motive into Medicare through Part C. To me,
yeah.
That's the poison pill.
Yeah, and not just a profit motive, but, you know, it creates all sort of systemic issues, because then you're going to get insurers, you know, insurers are going to protect their bottom lines. So they're going to start cherry-picking patients out of the Medicare pool. They're going to choose the healthiest, youngest seniors and try to attract them over to their services, because they're not going to have to pay out as many benefits. And that raises prices for and the premiums for the regular Medicare pool, because they're basically siphoning off, you know, the people that are cheaper to cover.
Yeah, I keep asking the question, how do I get a gig where I can get the most profitable aspects of my business and not the other ones? Just give me
a private insurer, I guess.
Yeah, like the health insurance. I get the people who are working, people who have jobs are generally going to be healthier. They're the ones who are going to not use health care as much. And, the taxpayer and the government, you take the people who use health care the most, people who in the first 5 years and the last 5 years of their lives.
Exactly.
So where does this go from there?
Okay, well, so that's on the Obamacare side of this, and that's why, you know, any claims, I mean, I know that Fox News on Friday, they had what's that guy's name, Ron Johnson, or whatever, Johnson Jr., their legal analyst that they pull out sometimes on Fox News, and he was claiming that, oh, man, you're seeing Medicare patients being turned away because of the sequester right now. Wait till Obamacare comes in, and it's going to kill off millions of seniors, you know? And so, you know, that's just ridiculous. That is a complete misunderstanding of Obamacare's Medicare savings. Now, as for the sequester and this specific example of Medicare beneficiaries being turned away, so this is one of the real-world effects of the sequester that Republicans are trying very hard to say, oh, that's just imaginary. That's never going to happen. Well, it's happening. And the reason why it's happening is because the sequester was designed in a way that would be, you know, it would be blunt, it would be ham-fisted, it would be across the board, and we're seeing the consequences of that right now. You know, I saw a couple of Republicans trying to say that, oh, well, that's a lie because the sequester doesn't actually cut Medicare or Medicaid. Well, that's true for Medicaid. It is not true for Medicare. If you actually read the Budget Control Act, it specifically says that cuts to Medicare will not exceed 2%, but that means that that 2% cut is there. And that's the cut that's beginning to affect these local cancer clinics. The way that cut is structured is that is a cut to Medicare Part B. And one of the things that Medicare Part B does cover is certain administrations of drugs that involve physicians. Because cancer drugs require a physician to administer them,
right. This
is affecting that. So usually what these clinics get is they get payments, they get reimbursements from Medicare for the price of the chemotherapy drugs themselves, plus a 6% payment for, you know, storing the drugs and the administrative costs associated with the drugs. Now, now that we have this 2% cut that's beginning to affect them, you know, these guys, they can't control the price of the chemotherapy drug. They can't get that 2% reduction from the price of the drug,
right,
because that's up to the, you know, drug manufacturer. They have to pay whatever they charge.
And we haven't negotiated that down either.
Yeah, exactly. And so that 2% cut instead has to come entirely out of this 6% payment that's supposed to come on top of that. And so that amounts to basically a 30% pay cut, you know? Like, you imagine that you're buying a chemotherapy drug, the cheapest chemotherapy drug in the world, and say it's like $50, right? So the way it works is usually Medicare will reimburse the clinic for that $50 plus 6% of that $50 for administrative costs. So that's another $3, right? Now, because of the sequester cut, instead of getting that plus 6%, they're getting plus 4%, which means that instead of getting the $3 on top of that $50 for the drug, they're getting $2.
Yep.
That's a 33% reduction in administrative costs, and, you know, it's basically a pay cut. Now, obviously, these drugs don't cost $50. They cost a lot more than that. So basically, what these clinics are having to do is they have to make a choice. Do we absorb that 30% reduction in administrative costs? Do we take that out of pay? Do we take that by reducing staffing? Or do we make the hard choice and basically turn away some of the patients that we can't afford to give these drugs to anymore? And that's what they're doing.
So can you make the argument then that, you know, this oncology group, that they're a death panel? I mean, because I've heard death panels being, in fact, you talked about Peter Johnson Jr., the Fox analyst, who, you know, I guess last week, you know, brought up the death panel thing again. Is this what this is?
Well, I mean, the death panel in this case is the sequester cut, you know. That is what's forcing these, you know, these are local oncology clinics that are these, like, small community-based clinics. And, you know, these sequester cuts are forcing them to make a very, very difficult decision, which is, do we start firing doctors? Do we start firing nurses, you know? Or do we turn away some patients? There have actually been some oncology clinics who are saying, you know what, we're going to keep giving these drugs to these patients for as long as we can. But even the guys who are doing that have said, we're not going to be able to keep up with this. If we have to keep doing this, we're going to last for a couple months before we just go bankrupt.
And there's my problem with, you know, a lot of folks have said, and I'm an advocate for Medicare for all. I'm an advocate for a national socialized healthcare program. My fear in that idea, though, is that you end up with the kind of people who rammed through this sequester. And it was proposed by the president and some Democrats, but it was really, really done by Republicans because they chose not to do anything else. My fear is that when you have a system that is funded by tax dollars, that's funded by we the people, that you get folks who will starve it, and you end up with these kind of situations that happen that harm real people, especially at the people at the bottom.
Right. I mean, well, that's also indicative just of, like, a much larger problem that we have in our system of healthcare, which is where the government does not have the power to negotiate prices that well, you know, and so that's part of the reason that leads to this healthcare price inflation, which makes care in this country so unbelievably expensive that it prices people out of the system, you know. So, you know, I understand that concern, but at the same time, at least that centralized control would give a little more authority to maybe negotiate those prices down. So say, you know, these oncology clinics had a choice of not having to pay, you know, an arm and a leg for every cancer drug that they had to administer. If the government actually had, you know, the ability to negotiate those drug prices, no, you might not have as much of a problem with that.
Let me ask you a last line of question I've got for you, Cy. You know, we keep this number, this $716 billion number keeps popping up. And during the last presidential election, it was amazing how Paul Ryan was taking the same amount of money out of Medicare that he was accusing Obama for taking out. It's just a very different way of doing it. But this number's popped up again. And, you know, it's still scaring the hell out of my grandmother, who thinks, you know, we've seen these cuts. She saw the story that, you know, if, you know, seniors getting cancer aren't getting chemotherapy. There's this, all of this media frenzy around it. What's the story? I mean, where is this? What is it? Why?
Well, yeah. So, you know, so as I was sort of mentioning earlier, that $716 billion, that is not a benefit cut or anything like that. All that is that is a cut to providers which are servicing these private Medicare Advantage plans that tend to come in more expensive than regular fee-for-service Medicare does. That's just always been the case historically. It's been the case ongoing. And, you know, that's where these savings are coming from. And
but they're not,
I think
hold on. Well, see, that's even in your language. They're not savings. How can it be savings if it's costing people their lives? How can it be savings if it's taking away from healthcare?
Well, it's not taking away from the benefits. These are payments to providers that are being reduced.
So the insurance companies are going to see less profit.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I'm okay with that. That's a good idea.
Yep.
Because
And as Paul Ryan showed, he's probably okay with that too if he keeps putting it in his budgets, right?
Yeah, because I'm of the mindset that healthcare shouldn't be one of those things that we do for profit. My illness, getting cancer, should not be someone's profit motive. We shouldn't have a system that benefits some with others being harmed. When I have a heart, if I have a heart attack, someone should be going, cha-ching, I'm going to make a little bank on this. It seems perverse to me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it sets up just an entirely bad incentive pool, you know?
Yeah.
That's also what encourages things like, you know, treating the sickness instead of, you know, making sure that someone is healthy so that they don't have to keep going to the hospital to get care.
Yeah, and there's a whole conversation for a whole nother day that we'll have to pick up again at some other point. Sai Mukherjee, I appreciate the time. Health reporter, blogger over at thinkprogress.com. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Thinkprogress.org. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Sai's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
For and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, good news today as the U.S. Postal Service backed out on its threats to end Saturday mail delivery. And the service said, look, you know, we didn't want to do this. Congress has given us no choice. And as we've talked about on the program numerous times, this whole manufactured crisis, another one of these manufactured crises brought to us by our friends at the GOP, needless, senseless, mindless, but ideological. The idea, if we can starve enough, starve the beast, heap upon it mandates that nobody else has to go by, we can destroy it. And look, you know, I understand. Technology is putting a little dent in the Postal Service's business. Absolutely. But I also believe, look, this is part of the commons. It's part of one of the only constitutionally mandated functions in the country. Something that we absolutely need to have. And there are some things that we have mandated, like delivery to every single address in this country. that we don't do to any business or to any other entity. And there's a reason for that. The reason is, and understand this, if you didn't mandate it, companies wouldn't do it. Because there are some, a good number of addresses that would just be too expensive to service. It would just be too much. And they would say, you know what, it's not profitable, we're not going to do it. Understand, rural areas, you're the ones who would be hit first. And I saw this article over at the Intelligencer Journal in Lancaster that pointed out that they're going to be cutting hours at 21 small post offices in Lancaster County. 21 of them cut hours. The first to be right on the front, you're going to be the ones that are going to suffer the brunt of this first. It's going to happen. Even without ending Saturday delivery, they're still going to be cutting back. And doing away with and consolidating. So you're not going to have that local post office. You're not going to have you're just not going to have it. And I also saw an article that said, you know, there are going to be a number of post offices, especially the big ones here, that aren't going to work extended hours on April 15th on tax day. So you don't get it there by the close of business, you're late. Because it's always been the postmark. And what happens there? I look at this. Here's the reality. And this is one of those things where you go, why did they do it? What was behind it? What was the rationale? Explain it. I'm going to tell you flat out. During the Bush years, when they decided that they were going to heap on the Postal Service this mandate that no one else in the history of civilization has ever been saddled with, no company in the history of this nation, no company in the history of civilization has ever been saddled with a mandate that they pre-fund pensions 75 years into the future. Think about that for a second. Workers that haven't even been born yet, people who are not anywhere near retirement age, you're funding pensions for people who aren't even born yet. 75 years. Now, look, the actuarial folks look 30 years. They look about 30 years into the future. Some 40. I've heard 30 to 40. No one has. It's unheard of. 75 years is just absolutely unheard of. So when you hear that the post office is losing money, and we've talked to numerous postal employees. We've talked to various postal labor leaders and leaders who have all said the same thing. Look, if you took the mandate for a fully funded pension 75 years into the future over the next 10 years, if you took that away, the billions of dollars that they're having to put into this fund that nobody else has to do, that really makes no sense. If you took this away, post office is profitable. They're actually making money. You wouldn't have to raise the price of a stamp. You wouldn't have to lay off thousands and 100,000 workers. You wouldn't have to do any of that stuff. You wouldn't have to cut delivery. You wouldn't have to cut hours. You wouldn't have to do any of those things. You wouldn't have to diminish capacity. You wouldn't have to do any of that stuff. You would have a strong, vibrant postal service. But that's not good for big business, is it? That's not good for the people who want to take over. And look, there are privateers who think that the FedExes of the world should be doing all of it. And I disagree. They've got their niche markets. I've often said, you know, the reality is, I don't know that the competition is not helpful. There are some things that competition works well for. You know, who makes the best car, who makes good tennis shoes, you know, whatever, T-shirts, whatever. But something that benefits the society, something that's based on us doing things for ourselves, I don't know, you know. You set up a delivery system, and if you have the volume, it's more profitable, it's less costly, which is why we only pay, 45 cents for a stamp? You know what is my forever stamp? It doesn't even say anymore, mine are forever. I think it was 45 cents when I bought it. You look at other countries around the world where you're talking about a buck and a half. if not more. I can send a letter from here to California, 45 cents. And had we not done a lot of the insane things that we've done over the years, it'd probably be cheaper than that. But here again, it's not profitable for the few that we have this asset for the many. And that's really the bigger conversation in all of this. Because we keep hearing people talk about privatization. You know, we've got a governor who's hell-bent on privatizing the lottery, privatizing the wine and spirit shops that are making money for that we don't have to pay in taxes. And you look at all of the privatizations and privatization schemes in prison, and good for New Hampshire. New Hampshire just, they said, no, we're not going to privatize our prisons. They had four of these big, you know, these big for-profit prison companies who came in and gave 17 different proposals. Four companies, 17 different proposals on how they were going to privatize and profitize the prison system in New Hampshire. And the people said, no. In fact, the reports are that these 17 proposals were so complex and so large that the state had to hire a private consultant. Think about this for a second. They had to hire a private consultant at the cost of $171,000 just to evaluate the bids. Now, I love people who say, well, you know, like our governor, who says, well, we should look at options. Understand, we spent almost $3 million on the lottery privatization scheme just evaluating the bids. $3 million we could have spent on infrastructure or education or who knows what. I think we could have spent on it a lot better than giving it to consultants. But here, $171,000 of New Hampshire taxpayer dollars to evaluate the bids of four companies who have a track record. Look, I mean, the private prison proposal, the private prison ideas has been a failure. You look at what's going on in Ohio, where one of the big profiteers, the biggest private prison company in the country, took over one of the Lake Erie Correctional Institute, which became the first privately owned state prison. And what a state audit recently found? Mass abuse, horrible conditions, well below the standards the state had set, overcrowding, 130% of capacity. They found single cells with three people in them. Assaults on guards, assaults on inmates, up by 40%. And what they found is they found the companies cutting costs, cutting wages, everything that they could possibly do. Cutting sanitation, cutting food, cutting everything they could possibly do to do what? You know what the answer is. Maximize profit. Because it's profit over people. And I understand. Prisons are part of what we do. And we can get into the whole debate whether prisons are retribution or rehabilitative. We can get into that argument, but it's something that we do for ourselves. There shouldn't be a profit motive to this. At least that's my view. You should not have these big companies who are spending millions of dollars lobbying Congress, lobbying state legislators, so that we have profit. Because why do they do it? Well, why are they in business? They're not in business. Understand this. They are not in business to provide a service for the good of the state or the good of the country. That's not why they're in this. They're not in this out of the goodness of their heart because they feel community service is the heart of the central to their core business tenets. Come on. Do you buy that? They're in this for one reason. Profit. The reason anyone starts a business. The whole idea that capitalism is run on, that you incentivize things because people will work because it's for profit. This is what we've done to higher education. This is what we're doing to K through 12 education, and it's what we're doing to prisons. It's what our governor has decided that he says he's going to do with our wine and spirit shops, our lottery, and anything else he can hock off. Because there are people in this country who believe that, you know what? There should be nothing in the hands of we the people. And over the weekend, you know, I took my family to D.C. and we saw all of the treasures that Washington, D.C. had to offer. The monuments of Jefferson and Lincoln and the memorial to FDR and to MLK and the Vietnam Wall and all of these things that we value as these treasures that are ours. There are those who say, you know what, those shouldn't be for free. They shouldn't be there for you just to go to. You should have to pay for them, like the capitalists want. And I ask the question, as you go down that road, how much will it cost? And what will it cost us as a society? Sad, sad stuff. But the good thing is, thanks to the $45 million in lobbying that the for-profit private prison industry has put in, they've saved themselves, because the biggest one, CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, was near bankruptcy in 2000. In 2011, they had a net income of more than $162 million. I guess for them. The question is it good for us? And I say no. This is something we should, could, and must do for ourselves. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. And they're talking in the town where it's at. They shout it. I hear them talking everywhere. They're talking never stops. But all their words are whispering. Won't make you go away. Hey, they close the factory down at nothing.
Your proud defender of a working class majority, Rick Smith.
Earth, sky.
A survey of stars in the Milky Way has revealed something new about how our galaxy formed. It found evidence that the inner, thin disk of the Milky Way grew organically from the inside out, like the rings of a tree. The surrounding outer disk likely formed all at once. Astronomer Judy Cheng of UC Santa Cruz was part of a survey of stars called Segway that analyzed starlight of 118,000 stars in the disk of our Milky Way.
We looked at different parts of the disk. So the disk can be thought of as two components. There's a thin disk, which is what you see in the sky, and then a thick disk, which is not visible from the Earth, but is made up of old stars.
Stars create heavier elements as they age, and when stars die, the heavier elements become part of the next generation of stars. The Segway survey analyzed starlight to reveal the metals in stars. The metals showed which parts of our galaxy have seen several generations of stars come and go.
The idea behind Segway is to use the stars that we observe and study their chemical compositions, look at their motions and also their positions in the galaxy to understand how the stars got there, when they were born, and how they fit into our picture of the galaxy.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website for ricksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So Darth Cheney was talking to a bunch of Republicans behind closed doors. I guess they got the electric heart there pumping just long enough for him to chime in. And because evidently he looked in really good spirits, and he spoke really clearly and lucidly, according to Florida Republican Stephen Sutherland. And I love the part lucidly. Maybe the past, not so much. Maybe that whole Bush term, just a thought. Anyway, his assessment of our position in North Korea, we're in deep doo-doo, quote, unquote. You take that for what it means from Darth Cheney. Let's go to Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, deep doo-doo, the assessment from our former vice president.
this is the kind of talk that you get when the issue is not evolving fast enough. We get these continual threats every day from North Korea, but we don't really know how much the situation is changing day to day. And it leaves a nice window for someone like Dick Cheney to reinsert himself into the public dialogue and offer some comments, a new assessment that I don't think is based on any information that the rest of us don't already have.
I think it comes from the same place that he pulled most of his cherry-picked facts from, right behind him and, just yanked it right out. Because, this is when you come from a place of, hey, let's go bomb stuff, you come up with that.
Luckily, I don't think this affects America, in the slightest, and our security in the region. It's funny, we've sent over one of our craziest basketball players. We now have a loose cannon or a loose blunderbuss like Dick Cheney now saying these types of things. The reality is, though, it seems like we're as prepared as we need to be. The Japanese are getting as prepared as they need to be. The South Koreans, a little bit nonchalant, but are also said they're ready for whatever North Korea has to offer. Luckily, people can make comments like this, and it really it doesn't mean that something on the ground is changing. And I really don't think we're in deep doo-doo surveying the field here.
So when you hear someone like Lindsey Graham coming out and saying, we're gonna basically turn North Korea to glass, that's just hyperbole and they're just blowing smoke.
Certain individuals may wish to see that because of how frustrated they've been dealing with North Korea for this long. I don't think the people in the military who are tasked with making those decisions, and I don't think anybody in the region, in the Korean Peninsula, wants to see the North Koreans suffer that kind of fate, as crazy as they've been to negotiate with.
A second ago you said we sent Dennis Rodman over, and part of me thinks...
We sent, right?
We sent? is that our best diplomat in the region?
Well, he's an American carrying a passport, so in some degrees, the United States government is responsible for allowing this gentleman to go to North Korea.
Because I wondered, how did he get there? I mean, because I don't think I could just hop on a plane to go to North Korea, could I? I mean, I can't go to Cuba. We just found out the Treasury Department said that Beyonce and Jay-Z or Jazzy or whatever, they were able to go to Cuba. I can't go to Cuba. Can I go to North Korea?
I'm not sure if it would just, requires a stopover in Montreal before you can go almost anywhere. I know that works for Cuba, and maybe the Jay-Z was able to cut some of the red tape there and didn't need to go to Canada first. But there are ways of getting into some of these countries. North Korea telling people to leave the North Korean peninsula, over the past few days because of their hostile rhetoric and the sort of war preparations attitude they're trying to present here. But it has been very possible to go to North Korea if you have at least rudimentary connections and will to do so.
No, I have no will to go. I have no interest in going there whatsoever. But, if one would want to.
Well, I don't think you'll end up there mistakenly, just getting on your average flight.
So as someone who covers the UN and who spends a lot of time, covering that stuff, what is the general feeling here? Is this just another, hey, they want concessions, they want something, they want the U.S. to undo the sanctions? How much of this is actual? How much of this is just the same old, same old?
I think people at the UN have an interesting existence and perspective on this, which is that for most of the year, North Korea is a non-issue. It's something, when that first, not the first, but the third nuclear test that North Korea has done a little over a month ago, it made the news, but it was a very definite cycle. You knew that 3 weeks later, the Security Council would have a meeting and they'd unveil sanctions. It's clockwork almost how this North Korean situation has unfolded over the past few decades. Now, I've never been at the United Nations when a real, tremendously surprising conflict breaks out, luckily. But barring that from happening, I think we're puttering along as we have in the past. We'll await the next test. We'll await the next round of sanctions. I don't think anyone's really stapled to their radios or their TVs waiting for a crazy development to happen here.
Well, so good. Because a lot of people, a lot of my Warhawk friends are like, wow, we got to go over there. We got to take him out. And I'm going, and I heard him being, Cheney compared him to Saddam Hussein. And it just seemed to me the rhetoric and there was a buildup and yes, let's go get him. Let's go. And I'm going, no. Didn't we just get out of a mess similar to?
I think what many people want to do is neutralize him. They don't want to take him out necessarily, but the problem is,
the kind of rhetoric we're hearing does the opposite of neutralizing someone. It turns them into the face of evil, and then it's a little bit harder to ignore them and allow the policy of isolation to work. So it seems like people are working perhaps at cross purposes here.
Yeah. Well, good. Let's come to domestic policy. Obama came out with his budget. Got to be honest, not a big fan of the chained CPI. Not a big fan of lowering Social Security checks for seniors in the future. Think it's a bad idea. Think it's a bad compromise, and I think it's gonna harm Democrats. I think it's a I shouldn't say bad idea. I think it's a stupid idea. Republicans got to be thrilled with it, though.
I think they're probably thrilled with it because it's an unpopular, unsuccessful budget in many ways. It certainly reaches out to certain constituencies by writing in the little pet things that they want. You've got the Buffett rollback. You've got certain new revenues for road and rail that aren't going to be passed. He can make stands on a number of issues, which you'd think would make it a strong budget, but unfortunately it seems so riddled with these different gestures that the end result is something that I don't think Obama is really going to stand behind with his full faith. And given the history of budgets over the past few years, it's not going to pass.
So the question then becomes, do we ever get a budget? I mean, because the Ryan budget, in my view, is dead on arrival. I've got Republican friends who look at the Obama budget dead on arrival. Is there any middle ground?
I don't think so, at least not on the budget. It seems like Washington can only do one thing at a time. So you've got you've got a dozen Senate Republicans moving, going to the White House for dinner as we speak right now, under the pretense of talking about the budget. I really don't believe they're there to do that. I don't think that's where Obama is concentrating his political energy right now. I think, given what I was hearing, on the other side of things with the immigration and border security debate on Congress today, that seems like the serious political issue. That's the one that I imagine he's putting more of his chips behind, because we've got real policies with real impacts here, and he actually can stand to gain something because the bill could pass.
Right.
The budget, I don't think he's going to go into that fight just to gain a little bit of credit for having another budget.
Yeah, see, to me, and I believe the same thing. So for me, throwing that chain CPI out there, and even the prospect of a Democrat being willing to lower or cut Social Security benefits just seems dumb to me.
You're right. There's some certain concessions he made in there, which it seems like if he's not really concentrated on getting this budget passed at any cost, why would you ruffle the feathers of some of your own folks, by putting something out there like that?
And to me, I look at all the talk about the guns issue. The gun thing now seems to me, because I don't think you're going to see any real serious, you'll see some background check stuff happen, but I don't think you're going to see anything really serious happen on the guns issue. I just think it's the shiny thing right now. It's what everyone's, and I saw Manchin and Pat Toomey had their press conference today where they said, oh, we're gonna have extended background checks, which I think is common sense. I think virtually every NRA member is in favor of.
Of course. You said exactly what I was thinking, which is I was looking on Twitter and seeing David Plouffe and some of these other White House people giving these, showering praise on Manchin and Toomey for doing this. And on one hand, yeah, they're both A-rated NRA guys. But at the same time, these two voices are not going to change the gridlock. They single-handedly, maybe they can put a little pressure on the Senate bill, but God forbid, this is not going to pass in the House, no matter what Joe Manchin and Pat Toomey do. And it seems like the gun issue for the moment, comparing, again, reminding ourselves that it looks like Washington can only do one thing at a time, the gun one is turning into a little bit too much showboating, a little less progress. The immigration border security debate looks like where all the serious talk is going on.
Well, and where's that going to leave us? What are you seeing at this point? Are we seeing the guest workers? Are we going to do like they wanted to do during the Bush years and chip guest workers so we know where they are all the time so we can go get them?
In many ways, it doesn't seem too much different from the Bush years. We're talking potentially about a 10-year track to get green cards for people who are here illegally at the moment. But that's conditional, though, on the fact that you have 100% border security. Which, on one hand, I think when it was used during the Bush years, many people rolled their eyes at this concept or at the staggering cost that would entail. Now I think it's certainly still expensive. It's certainly still ambitious. But now that we're in the mindset of drones and other types of digital ways of securing an area, it does seem a little bit closer to reality, and maybe we don't have as visceral reaction to the drones and like a laser-type border as they have, I believe, around Saudi Arabia in the desert, than it is imagining everyone at the back of a pickup truck with a gun all along the border, or a fence at that. So it does seem like a debate that's evolving a little bit, yeah. And I really think it's not the most popular proposal, but it offers tangible changes and tangible concessions from both sides, very reasonable concessions, I think, and it means there might be some progress on this.
Yeah, I've actually always been very pro fence. I think we build a big 30, 40, 50-foot fence. Not that the fence works, but that we're building something and putting people to work. I think it's a building project. Think of it as a jobs bill. It's not going to work. And then I'm pro-moat, because I think we could start, people digging ditches. Not that moats work either, but, I'm very pro-jobs. And maybe this is going to be something that we get both sides to say, we need to focus on jobs and getting people back to work. Here's a start of it. Maybe just a start.
It could be. I didn't see the two different bills, the budget and the border security bills, really talking to each other very much in that way. You're right. If there is going to be progress on fulfilling the pledge of a secure border, it may turn into an economic justification for jobs, and we all wouldn't hate seeing that.
Yeah, I mean, because you build the 30-foot wall. You got the people doing that, and then you have an industry that crops up around building 31-foot ladders. Seems like a good job to me.
Right. You probably have an industry on the other side of the border that was maybe a little more effective that was also into building 30-foot ladders. So it's not the end of the argument, but it does seem like this debate is at least active compared to the gun one, which, again, I'm just amazed at seeing everyone tooting their horn on this gun. In fact, this is no progress that's really being made.
No, it's just grandstanding.
And I think we got something on immigration, perhaps.
And, the thing is, I keep bringing up this idea of jobs because that's my sole focus. You go back to 2010 when the Republicans swept in with the T-Twit revolution there, that well-funded billionaire group pushed it right on through, and they said, laser-like focus, jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet I've seen everything, every distraction, everything but a jobs bill or anything that would create jobs. And I look at, the class of 2013, the class of 2012, the class of 2011, the last several years of college graduates who have been saddled with $1 trillion in student loan debt, and their prospects for the future, just abysmal. Not even dismal, just abysmal.
Well, thank you for the very nice introduction to the topic that I was most involved with today. I will be graduating in the class of 2013 in just a few weeks. And I was listening in on this conference call. It was a policy announcement from the Economic Policy Institute. They've just put out some new research. And I wanted to break down in tears during this conference call and break my professional barrier there, because the outlook that they're forecasting for people who graduated since the beginning of the Great Recession and then extending a few years down the road, probably to about 2016, this group, about 7 years of folks, are really going to be competing with each other in a unique way compared to almost all our predecessors. It's going to take 10 to 15 years, of this one study said, to be able to match just the earnings. This doesn't mean all the lost money, which can never be recovered, but just to match the earnings and wages of people who had graduated as recent grads before the Great Recession, basically from 1995 to 2007. So a big hole, and the consensus, again, was that the only real way to tackle kind of broad economic, labor problem is to inject more stimulus in, is to create, to change the overall demand for labor, and that targeting it really is not going to be the case because degrees are so mismatched. People are, college grads are settling for jobs that they don't even need the degree for.
Yep.
It's not an education issue. It's just an issue about overall economic demand for labor.
And to me, again, it goes back to our trade policies. It goes back to immigration policies. It goes back to a whole bunch of decisions that they've made in Washington that are under the guise of being business friendly and promoting business. What we've done is we've given away industry after industry. And I'm sorry, the insane, stupid things we've done, we can undo if we had the political will.
Sure. And again, there were some points of optimism in here, and I think one of them was that there are industries that are popping up to employ people, and that even though we have lost certain industries to outsourcing and just to changing technology and the evolution of business, that there are certain industries that will be able to hire people. It's just that they are not incentivized to do so now. The overall economic climate is not fiery enough to get those people hiring again. And perhaps down the line, once we get the engines of growth turning again, be it through stimulus or anything else, people will be able to get employed. But, you know, in the meantime, it's a lot of people's long-term earnings potential being sort of wasted.
And not just that. I mean, then you take this to Social Security. The fact that you're not making as much in the early years of your life means you're not putting as much into the Social Security fund, which means that it's going to be short-funded for the years to come, and it just compounds all of the problems moving down the road, because right now we're bickering over dumb stuff instead of actually figuring out how do we get people back to work. You've got people in Congress who are saying, well, you know, the Fed shouldn't have a dual role. They should only be going after inflation. They shouldn't worry about jobs. Let that to the invisible hand and the free market. And I say, no, we absolutely need the Fed to go back to the idea of promoting full employment so that you have people who, like you, who are able to get a job to pay those student loans that you've been saddled with. Speaking of, what kind of student loan debt are you going to be carrying when you graduate?
In the five figures, thankfully on the low five figures, and I've got a job to be able to start chipping away at that. But the reality here is, you know, a very interesting one to study. People, young people, are going to have to be ingenious and in ways they haven't been in the past. This woman who's a serious economist and is used to dealing with technical terms, basically at a loss for solutions, to say young people are going to have to turn to their friends to be able to financially support them. They're going to need to really figure out a way to recoup all these lost costs. And they've got to change the way they think, too. A few years ago, back in 2007, I remember hearing on NPR and all these other things, this mantra for young people that as soon as you graduate from college, it's to your benefit to change jobs regularly, to keep going into the hot new environments, testing out your skills, seeing if you can advance, and all the while slowly bumping up your wages. That kind of a mantra does not apply at all in this 2013 market.
No.
And those 2007 kids have established themselves, whereas there's going to be more challenge for people graduating, at this time, unfortunately.
I think your entire generation should say, screw you, we're not paying the loans back.
It does seem likely that there will be modifications to some loan programs down the line. I've tried not to account for any of that, and I do get a little concerned for people my age who I hear talking about, oh, well, the government will just forgive these loans. As it stands now, those are some of the heaviest weights you could bear your entire life, and they'll take you to the grave if you're not able to pay them.
Yep.
But there are people who are optimistic that there will be reform. I'd like to think maybe something will come out of it, but not a full repayment. And to budget around that is unfortunately, just as unwise as this current situation is unfortunate.
And lastly, some fun news at the UN surrounding Greece.
Fun at first, and then it turned into kind of a sad conflict that is one of these UN things you run into every once in a while. The Republic of Macedonia became independent in 1991. They were formerly part of the Soviet Yugoslavia. So they were trying to rebrand. They're trying to shed their name, and they want to be called the Republic of Macedonia.
Sure.
Unfortunately, their neighbors, Greece, who have a state, a region in their country called Macedonia, and say that it represents the area of the ancient Macedons, said you can't have that name. So they've been blocking Macedonia from using their actual country name at the UN for over 20 years now. And there was a UN diplomat at the UN yesterday trying to mediate these guys, get some progress. It doesn't look like they're able to come to it. And in the process of writing this article, I've been fielding just dozens of emails from people on both sides of this. It is one of the nastiest ethnic and cultural disputes that I've come in contact with in a long time. And just such a peculiar thing, one country being able to change what another is called, by a veto at the UN.
Jeez.
Messy stuff.
Do we not have bigger problems?
Well, I think it does seem funny, but I guess if your name, your Macedonia is actually forced to be called FYROM, the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia at the UN and in FIFA or in the NHL, players have that abbreviation instead of Macedonia, it kind of haunts you. If you want to change your name, you'd think that you'd be able to do it, and it's just an interesting cultural and historical dispute.
Well, let them go to war over it. War is good for the economy. Gets people back to work.
It may be good for the Greek economy at this point. They could use whatever they could get.
Luke Vargas, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you.
Pleasure always. Take
Thanks
care.
So much. Let's take a quick right around here. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It was a gala evening of celebration, libations, commendations, and insidious corporate cynicism. Hosted in March by a financial trade publication, this annual Black Tie Awards dinner on Wall Street made news when the award for Best Crisis Management was handed out. Yes, an award actually exists for what amounts to PR deception, deflection, and dissembling by a corporation that has been caught making the year's biggest honking boo-boo. For example, the 2012 prize was taken by GE for its razzle-dazzle ducking and dodging over the fact that its reactors were at the core, literally, of the Fukushima nuclear nightmare in Japan. Equally stunning was this year's awardee, J.P. Morgan Chase. America's biggest bank was feted for its handling of last year's embarrassing discovery that, oops, investors lost $6.2 billion in bad trades made by one of the bank's chief investment arms. Accepting the award for its media hocus-pocus, a Morgan executive quipped, "Crisis? What crisis?" Such gaiety, such absurdity. Especially since a U.S. Senate subcommittee had just issued a devastating 300-page report showing that Morgan's destructive corporate culture of greed and deception caused the loss, and that the bank's top executives repeatedly misled investors, regulators, and the public at large about what really happened. Not only did they mislead, but they did so illegally, for it's against the law for investment banks to make untrue statements about the risk of the securities they sell. This is Jim Hightower saying, but Wall Street narcissism appears to be an antidote to personal embarrassment. For Morgan's jolly bankers showed up to collect their crisis management award, even though everyone knew by then that they had grossly mismanaged their crisis. Wall Street is not merely absurd, it wallows in its absurdity.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do, they smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers, backstabbers, they smile in your face.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there from the website, TheRickSmithShow.com, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Of course, today we talked a lot about education. This whole standardized test thing, to me, I've really come to the view that it's ridiculous. It, you know, and I go back to, you know, my daughter yesterday just distraught, came home angry, and it's, you know, this is not what education should be about. Honestly and truthfully, it's not. It's not what I want for them. And, you know, we're going to find out tomorrow what's in store when I decide that I don't think I want her doing this. I don't think it's the right thing. I don't think it's good for her. I don't think it's good for education as a whole. I think there's a lot to this that just flat wrong. And, you know, we're going to find out. We're going to walk through this process and see where this takes us. Tomorrow night I should have an interesting tale to tell one way or the other. But, you know, I look at this and not the direction I want education going, not the direction I want my kids going. And it's to me that simple. I believe that we should have local control of our schools, local control of what is taught in the classroom, and it's that simple. I don't want it privatized. I don't want it profitized. That simple. Anyway, thanks for listening. Get up. Get active. Get engaged. Meeting adjourned. We got work to do. Get to it. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming like